to Reveal is back, and this time it's better than ever. We're giving away over 100,000 prizes, including three new Fiat 500 cars. Buy any slice and peel a tab for your chance to win. Ciao, I'm Dominic Primucci, inviting you to taste the difference.
439-444-PIZZA-NOVA. This is Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
All right. Welcome to Primetime Sports for Monday, October 7th. Jeff Blair, joined with Stephen Brunt. Mr. Brunt, our final week, 4-7. We go 2-5.
Yes, but, everything changes
with
now.
A different name, but we won't reveal the name yet.
Yeah, it's going to be... I haven't never worked in that. I've never done that time slot.
I think it's about the only time slot I haven't done.
Yeah. You've never done mornings. I know that.
No. Not
you would remember.
Actually, that's not true. No, I did for about a week. Like, I want to say 8 years ago, I did mornings when they were sort of, I believe I did it with Jeff Lumby. I know I did it with Jeff Lumby one time when they were searching around. So anyhow, we'll be on 2-5. Tim and Sid, a week from today, will be taking over. And going from
appropriately on Thanksgiving, correct?
Appropriately on Thanksgiving.
People will give thanks for
that's right.
Tim and Sid.
You can insert your turkey jokes and everything there at that particular point in time. So you've been a busy man. Your time off. Grass doesn't grow on you. Don't let grass grow under your feet. You're in Anfield this week.
I was in Anfield on the weekend, yes. I was there Saturday. I was in Liverpool last night. I went with my one of my boys. He's red. He's 100% red. God love him. And we went over. He's been there before. He went over and saw a match, sat in the cop, and I've been over there. I was over there back in the days when George Gillette owned the team, which is not something, by the way, you mentioned when you were in
Liverpool. I was going to say, I wonder, at no point yesterday did you go to someone and say, you know, the last time I was here, it was in George Gillette's private jet.
I'm a good friend of George Gillette. That's not something you ever say at Liverpool. It's an amazing place, like Anfield, and I'm quite happy to go along. I'm not a lifetime anything, but but it's a great. It is one of the great experiences in sport. And, you know, there's stuff, some things are not what you would hope they would be, you know, and look, you and I, we've talked about this. We've been lucky. You've seen the world, seen a lot of different stuff, been a lot of places. Somebody asked me, I'm with the Calgary guys the other day, and they asked me if I had a bucket list of anything I still wanted to do in sports as a spectator. I was at Anfield, I was just outside the stadium talking to them. And I said, no, you know, really, we were just lucky. Like we came through in an era when, if you were a newspaper columnist, especially, they would send you places. You actually, you know, and pay for it, and you could go and experience things and write about it. And you know, I've seen pretty much all the stuff you want to see in sports. I'm not a golf guy, so I've never been to the Masters, and I can live with that because I don't like golf particularly. But you know, like the Super Bowls and the big fights and the Olympics and World Cups and Euros and. Oh, you know, I cover the Rugby World Cup a couple of times. I've done some interesting stuff, but I'll tell you, being in Anfield, so this is for people who don't know, that's the home stadium of Liverpool Football Club. It is, you know, it's changed. It's a great big honking stadium now. It's 50,000 plus seats. But Liverpool is a small town. Like, it feels like a small town, a small city. It feels like Hamilton is what it feels like. An industrial town, port city, lots of great history, very cool old architecture. It's very fixed up now. Downtown, it's very kind of spruced up and clean, but at its core is this, you know, working class sense of identity. And the focus of that, it's not just the one football club, it's two. You know, you're red or you're blue. From Anfield, you look across the park and there's Goodison Park, the home of Everton,
right?
Like, they're right beside each other, these two stadiums. And Liverpool has the glorious history and all the championships, and Everton has not, but it's been there. It's actually was there before Liverpool Football Club was. It's older. But, you know, you go into this place and the cop stand, which is in one end, is this great, huge one tier of humanity. If you look at it back in the old days when it was a terrace, when they stood, it was like a wave of people going up and down. And when they sing, when the crowd sings, You'll Never Walk Alone, which is a fabulously hokey, wonderful song, I'm telling you, it is one of the most emotional things I've ever experienced in sport. It really is. And, you know, it's legitimate that, you know, that people feel ownership of that team. it's, you know, it's owned by John Henry and his crowd, mm-hmm. same people own the Red Sox. But it's not owned by them. It's a, that's in trust. The community owns that team. That is the community's team. Things like the Hillsborough disaster are front of mind,
mm-hmm.
right? That's, you know, we're 25 years and plus on from Hillsborough. And yet, you know, you'll see reminders of that and signs about that and people wearing shirts about that and flags being waved right now, every game, every match. There's a, you know, there's an ongoing effort to obliterate the Sun newspaper
mm-hmm.
in Liverpool because of the way they covered Hillsborough, right? So if you sell the Sun in Liverpool, people will come in and say, take that out of here. Never mind not buying it. And, you know, Liverpool, so they played Leicester City on Saturday, and Liverpool's in first, and Leicester City's playing very well. They're in, you know, they're third right now, still on the tables, but climbing, playing very well. And Liverpool had played a midweek Champions League game against Salzburg, and it turned into a tougher match than they were supposed to. But they were up 3-0, and then Salzburg came back, and they had to play their asses off just to win that match. And they got a beautiful goal from Sadio Mane, and they were up against Leicester. And then you could just see them run out of gas right there. Legs just were like lead. And Leicester came back, and they tied the match. And the crowd, you know, that idea, like I always think home field and all that stuff and people, athletes, I always think most of that's hooey, right? It doesn't mm-hmm. matter. But the force of the crowd in the Kop, cheering these guys on, you know, sensing that they were dragging, sensing that the match might be lost. They've got a historic opportunity to win. They've never won the Premier League as the Premier League. And honest to God, like, it lifted those guys and pushed them right up the pitch. It felt like they were being pushed right up. And, they won on a late penalty. And, you know, Jurgen Klopp's fantastic. He's a great character. He's the perfect guy there. But just, you know, a sense of event and occasion, but I guess something organic, Jeff. You know, like so much of the stuff we deal with feels prefab,
mm-hmm.
and that's real. You know, it just feels like it's even though the crowd's half, you know, it's not half filled, but it looks like a lot of Norwegians there, and there's a lot of people from Asia and a lot of people from all over the world. Same as when you go to Old Trafford, it's not exactly, not everybody's there from Liverpool, but my God, it still feels like a real thing.
You know what I've always found interesting about Anfield. And I had this pointed out to me. You know, you talked about the fans saying you'll never walk alone. They don't start the match until it's concluded.
That's right.
And it's interesting. I think it was Ian. It was a manager from one of the smaller teams. Ian Holloway. I'm sorry. It was Ian Holloway who talked about how he was managing. I don't know if he was managing Hull at the time, whatever it was. But he made the point that, you know, his father grew up a Liverpool fan, and he made the point of standing on the touchline as an opposing manager when the song was being sung until it was finished, singing along, and then going and sitting in the dugout. And that is, again, that's just, it seems improper to start playing while the song is being sung. It's really bizarre.
And it's not an ancient tradition. Like, you know, it's funny because it's, you know, it's the Jerry and the Pacemakers version, right? And it comes from a time, I didn't realize this, but I, you know, I did the Anfield tour this week as well, which is really, it's a great tour. My God. And I'll tell you, they're cranking people through there at 20 pounds a head. They're making a fortune. But they had before matches in the 60s, especially, they would just play pop music.
Mm-hmm.
Over the tannoy, right? And so people would sing along with the songs. The Jerry and the Pacemakers version of You'll Never Walk Alone, Jerry and the Pacemakers, Ferry Across the Mersey, etc. You know, Liverpool band, part of the great, you know, that great wave of Liverpool bands that included the Beatles. And people would sing along, and they picked it up then. So, you know, it's a show tune, right? It's Rodgers and Hammerstein. But they kind of adopted it. You know, and there are a bunch of those. They're weird ones. Like, you know, I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles, right? There's all these different teams in England have adopted different songs.
It's Manchester United is, this is the one by Stone Roses.
And Manchester Band, right? So, but this one is, there's a power to it when it comes, especially when the Kop sings together. And, you know, they react to stuff. Like, a great soccer crowd reacts to what's going on. The songs are there for a reason. Not just that they sing guys' names, mm-hmm. sing out to guys, but, you know, they react to things that are going on in the match.
Let me ask you this, because I have not attended a soccer match where VAR is in effect, VAR is in effect. You were there yesterday. Any impact at all the match?
Well, the penalty, right?
What does the crowd do in that?
Well, it's weird. It was because, you know, it was a funny match, right? Because Liverpool went up 1-0, and they could have been up 3-0. They were dominating the match. And then they say they ran out of gas, and Leicester comes back with the latish equalizer, and then Leicester's pushing forward, and it's tense, right? Because you can feel, you know, that the whole sense of this thing slipping away. And then they brought on Origi as a sub, and they got a kind of a burst of energy, and they go down. So it's the far, far end of the pitch from where I'm sitting, and they get a late penalty. But then after the penalty is called, after you see the referee point at the spot, then there's this pause, right? And everybody's going, oh my God.
You've got to wait.
Yeah, you got to wait. And it did, you know, it just kind of built the tension up to another level, actually.
And they show it? Did they show the video assistant replay in the stands?
There are no screens in that stadium.
Wow.
There are no screens. There are no video screens. There's a, you know, basic kind of pixel board scoreboard, but there are no video screens in
that
stadium.
So you can't see the review that is being looked at.
You can't see anything. Like, you couldn't see replays of the goals. You couldn't see anything like that. It's you know, if you had to experience it. Now, you could go home and watch it on Match of the Day that night. But no, you had to experience it. You had to experience it for real. And, you know, again, from where I was sitting, I was on the cop end. You know, you couldn't, it was a million miles away. I have no idea. I saw it later. It's, you know, it was marginal, but VAR up. I think they're, you know, again, it's sort of like the NFL stuff that they're not going to overturn a call. You know, if he had not called a penalty in that situation, you know, it would have been different. But if they're going to support the referee's decision, unless it's really bad, it was marginal. But, yeah, there was a kind of a crackle in the air, you know, because again, if they drop those points, now Manchester City lost, so they're now 8 points clear. Everything went kind of Liverpool's way. You know, the Spurs are falling apart. United lost on Sunday on the road to Newcastle. They're dead. So it's all kind of, you know, knock on wood for the sake of my boy Jake. Knock on wood, but it's all breaking their way right now.
In terms of a club, leaving aside any sort of international competition, is there any other club game, league game, I'm going to call it, you've been to that would match Anfield?
Nope.
Any stadium or NFL game?
I've been to great stadiums. Yeah, like, you know, the stadium in Dortmund in Germany is an unbelievable stadium, right? The stands are almost vertical.
Yeah.
I was there for a World Cup game, and it's a crazy, the Borussia Dortmund stadium, and it is a fantastic place to watch a match, but that was World Cup, right?
Right.
Who did I see there? Brazil and Ghana. It was a good match. But so I've been in great stadiums before in different play. But again, I've been lucky, but not in terms of I haven't seen. I've been to Old Trafford to see United play. I've seen Chelsea play at Stamford Bridge. I saw West Ham play at Upton Park. I sat in the away section at Upton Park, which is like a urinal. It's like sitting in a urinal. It's the most disgusting.
Or Fenway Park.
When they tore that place down, I didn't shed a lot of tears for that. Yeah, I've been to this Manchester City, the Commonwealth, whatever they call that stadium,
Etihad,
right, which was the Commonwealth Games stadium, and then, you know, Parc des Princes in Paris and a bunch of places. Yeah, I've been to a lot, but look, no, there is nothing. The short answer is, I don't think there's anything in sport that compares to that, in my experience, because it's pure, you know. Mm. And
Yankee Stadium after the World Series after 9/11.
Yeah, that was a particular thing, right? Like, this is every other Saturday.
Yeah, that's true. That's right.
And there's just that sense of, you know, again, the international tourist part of it aside, you know, tickets there cost like a friend of mine, since he's a ticket holder, lifetime a Liverpudlian, lives in Montreal, good pal of mine, and he very graciously gave us his tickets for the match. I think, you know, a ticket there, the face value of a ticket is like £35. So it's not, it's affordable to working people. Now, you know, on the secondary market, that £35 ticket's going to go for £500. But, there's a real sense that, you know, you're sitting with 50,000 people who sound like Ringo.
Yeah.
You know, and are living and dying for this, right? It's really, really distinct. And how, like, how many things are distinct, right? Everything's the same. It's corporate, the culture is so corporatized. It is, you know, you would know in 10 seconds that you were not anywhere other than there.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, you look at most North American arenas, baseball stadiums, football stadiums, so much of the crowd noise is spurred on by the scoreboard or by something pre-planned. It is very strange to see something organic.
Yeah, so no advertising, right? No advertising in the stadium. Aside from what's on the reader boards too. Yeah, but not much there even. Like, it's just like one little screen. Like, there was so little visual distraction. Mm-hmm. There was nothing that drew your eye away from the pitch. You were focused on the match, and there was not one thing in there. There was no gimmicks and no mascots and no, and they, you know, in Premiership they have some of that crap, mm-hmm. right? But there was none of that. There was not one thing other than, you know, the match, and, you know, at the interval you go downstairs, you grab a pie, you grab a pint, drink it fast because you can't drink in the stands. You can lay a bet, then you go back up, but you're watching the match. You're not there for kind of sports entertainment, you know. It's not about
are you a meat pie or a vegetable pie dude?
I will eat a meat pie, yeah. I ate a few and drank lots of really good beer, and I don't want to sound like an old dude, but before the notion came that we're going to turn sports into you don't have to know anything about the sport or care about the sport or have any history with it, you can go and just be entertained for 2 or 3 hours, stuff's going to happen, right? The NBA were really the first guys to do that. Mm-hmm. Just like, stuff's going to happen. Music's going to play. Things are going to explode. There's going to be a halftime show. Bring the kids. They won't be bored. You know, if you bring your kid to Anfield, he's going to sit there and watch 90 minutes plus of football. That's it. Like, that's the deal. And I'm not sure how many places in the world are like that anymore. It's, you know, look, it's a great experience. If people are there putting together their own bucket list for sport, I would put it right at the top.
It has been a busy weekend in sports. Mr. Brunt's trip to Anfield included. The Leafs continued their regular season, I should say. They split the weekend, a 4-1 win in Columbus on Friday, a 6-5 shutout loss to Montreal, or shootout loss to Montreal on Saturday, which was just absolutely, absolutely crazy. The baseball playoffs are ongoing. The Cardinals are leading the Braves 2-1, and Tampa Bay, the last we looked, was having their way with Zach Greinke and the Houston Astros. Cliff Floyd will join us at 4:30 to talk about that. There are four playoff games today, all of them available on Sportsnet. Jeff Merrick, host of Scotiabank Wednesday Night Hockey, the NHL and Sportsnet 31 Thoughts, et cetera, will join us at 4:55. Kyle Lowry has signed a one-year $31 million extension with the Raptors. More about that in a minute. The Leafs are at home tonight against the defending Stanley Cup champion St. Louis Blues. Darren Pang joins us. Amy Trask, our NFL analyst. And Bob Hunter, chairman and interim CEO of the Wolfpack Rugby League Football Club, will join us in studio. They won the million-pound game.
Yes, they did.
They are in Super League next year. And
had almost 10,000 people.
10,000 people.
At Lamport, the delightful Lamport Stadium.
And it's interesting reading some of the commentary on that, and The Guardian in particular. There is not a lot of love in some quarters of English rugby for the Toronto Wolfpack.
Yeah.
The fact that these guys are going to be playing against such storied names as St. Helens and Wigan, it just doesn't seem right.
You know, it's more, you know, like rugby league is so specific, right? Because it's a north of England thing. Mm-hmm. It's got a different history than rugby union, which came out of, you know, rugby school, and it's, you know, very much an upper class game. It was originally,
right.
You know, that's why there weren't professionals forever, right? But, you know, league comes from a kind of a grittier part of England. But, you know, they've got the team. They have Toulouse in that league now. They had the Spanish team, the Catalan Dragons,
right?
So they kind of got this is, you know, I think they'll be fine with this. It's a funny league, because, you know, it's not front of mind in England even. It's so regionally specific. It's front of mind in a very tiny mm-hmm. part of England. But there it's a big deal. But, you know, like the Rugby World Cup's on the go right now,
yeah.
right? That's – no one's talking about league there at this point.
No, but Bob Hunter will join us in studio. We've got to talk about Kyle Lowry. The Raptors are in Japan. Kyle Lowry signed a one-year, $31 million extension. I would direct you to Michael Grange's article in sportsnet.ca. Interesting article. Essentially, almost under our noses, it seems as if Kyle Lowry's kind of been boycotting the team. You know, the hand injury has provided convenient cover, but as Michael Grange said, you know, there were a lot of people who thought until he gets an extension, Kyle Lowry wasn't going to hit the floor. He missed a couple of team activities. He is with the team in Japan, but this removes probably, Steven, I would think, sort of the one. I mean, I don't know how good this team is going to be this year. They should be good enough to finish fourth, maybe win a playoff round. But an unhappy Kyle Lowry really had potential to upset things this year. So this at least would seem to remove that impediment.
Yeah, it's...
Or that talking
point.
Yeah,
well, it takes away a deadline, right? It takes away a kind of a countdown, you know, in terms of his future, or at least postpones it. And it's a good outcome for him and a good outcome for the team, right? Because the term is manageable. He's going to get paid very well for an extra year. And when he becomes a free agent, he has a chance to get paid, a better chance to get paid than he would have at the end of this season, correct?
Yes.
That's my reading of what Grange is writing. So, but yeah, I think it would have been an ongoing story. Had we been in contract countdown with Kyle Lowry, that would have been something that would have hovered over this team. And, you know, I think we've seen unhappy Kyle Lowry. I think we know what that looks like, right? It's not a lot of fun for anybody.
No.
And again, I'm not sure. And he's going to be, you know, as much as you say this is Pascal Siakam's team now, you know, it's Kyle Lowry's going to be the dominant personality on this team for as long as he's here. You know?
Yeah, I think it has to be Pascal Siakam's team for them to have success. That doesn't necessarily mean it's going to work out that way, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would think Kyle Lowry, from my point of view, Kyle Lowry's probably a surer thing than Pascal Siakam.
For this year, yeah.
For this year.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that.
And as Grange points out, Lowry ruled himself out of the exhibition games. They're playing in Tokyo. They're playing the Rockets Tuesday and Thursday. So that would be, I guess, today and Thursday in Japan. The Raptors played an inter-squad scrimmage last Thursday in Quebec City. 19 of 20 players were introduced to the crowd. Lowry was not part of that. And as Grange also points out, Lowry acknowledged on media day he'd been cleared for contact and had been playing golf since the procedure in mid-July, but that he wasn't going to suit up for the Raptors until the deal is done. So now, even with Lowry's $31 million on the books for 2020-2021, Toronto would still have $28 million to spend in a targeted manner, or as Grange says, to acquire salary in a trade next. And the whole idea, I think, with the Raptors, look, they want to contend, but I think they want to position themselves for the summer of 2021, which is going to be sort of the next big free agent summer, Giannis Antetokounmpo, among others, available. So there you go. That is the one, I guess, the one thing that could have gotten nasty out of the way for the Raptors. And now, you know, we'll see what happens with Pascal Siakam and his extension. But I think a lot of people around that team were just kind of wondering what would happen if Kyle Lowry didn't get that extension. And this should also, frankly, shouldn't have an impact. If you do have to move him, shouldn't have an impact on your ability to move him.
Yeah. No, I think it would have been a dark cloud had they not done this deal. And it's a funny, you know, we're into kind of a 2-year pivot for this team, right? It's again, it's the luxury. You can talk about that stuff after you win a championship, right? Because then no one will sweat it too much. But they're going to, you know, kind of be in a holding pattern, you know, for the next couple of years. They're going to try and they got to figure out if Pascal Siakam is in fact going to be that guy. They're going to have to pay him like he's that guy anyway, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're right. Then the move, you know, then we'll all be awaiting the move that puts him on the path, ideally, to another championship. But this next couple of years are going to be about positioning for the years after that, which is not, you know, again, not wholly satisfying from a fan point of view, but hey, you know, I think the fans are still got big smiles on their faces.
Oh yeah. And again, as long as you have Kyle Lowry, I think this team has a chance to be competitive. And it'd be great if they successfully defended their title, but I think most Raptors fans are realistic enough to understand what this future is going to be about. There will be an afterglow that will carry the team through this year and through this season, I should say. And then afterwards, you know, that's when it gets really interesting.
Well, that's when, you know, Masai is going to have going to have to pull another rabbit out of his hat.
Mm-hmm.
But they will be positioned to do that. I guess, you know, the one thing you worry about with Lowry is that, you know, you're kind of presupposing that he stays healthy and that he doesn't start declining. Because age-wise, we're at a, you know, at a phase where, you know, he probably won't get better 2 years from now than he is now. So you need you're going to need him. You're going to need a lot of minutes out of him.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to need him healthy, and you're going to have to hope that he's close to being, you know, still the prime time guy.
Whether or not he stays healthy, of course, is up to him, but at least it appears as if he will be happy. Cliff Floyd is our MLB analyst on Sportsnet and the MLB Network. We mentioned the Cardinals and Braves are going on right now, 2-1 for the Cardinals. Mentioned the Rays were beating up on the Astros. There are two more games tonight. Dodgers and Nationals, 6:30 p.m. on Sportsnet Ontario. Yankees and Twins, 8 p.m. on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Cliff Floyd will join us. It's primetime on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Network. Hey, primetime sports fans. Need a leg up in your picks? Oddshark.net is your source for the latest odds from leading authorities expert editorial content and detailed matchup picks. Looking for statistics and trends for an upcoming game? OddsShark.net has those too, and it's free. Expert in-depth analysis, stats, numbers, and trends to help you make the sharp game day picks, whether you want to get it on the football action, tonight's hockey game, or anything in between. Go to OddsShark.net. This is not a gambling site. A reminder, by the way, that our Champions of Rec League Cup contest has closed insofar as your ability to enter your team. But now that you've entered your team, you've nominated your team, to find out if you qualify, begin the process. You can tune in 3 times per weekday to listen for your team names. What you're going to do is set your alarms for 7:30 a.m. then 10:30 a.m., 3:30 p.m. If you're setting your alarms for 3:30 p.m., you probably have a pretty good social life. But if you hear your team name, call back within 590 seconds, and you will move on to the voting round. Any team member can call back to qualify as long as they have the name and email of the person who nominated their team. Of course, this contest gives you a chance to play at the Mattamy Athletic Center. Joe Bone and Jim Ralph will call the game live on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. It'll be piped into the arena. There'll be an after party and all sorts of good stuff. If you have a team but didn't nominate it in time, you can enter at sportsnet.ca/590 for your chance to be the wild card team that moves on to round 3 of the contest. This contest, by the way, is open to Ontario residents only. Visit sportsnet.ca/590 for details. And I don't know yet about the mascot thing. There are a couple of people.
It's moving. It's moving along. I think there's a cause.
Yes. I believe there's a cause.
J.R. Diggs is working on that. I believe that there is already they've already hit a number, but they're trying to hit another number. It's going to be a significant amount of money.
So I
he said, just trust him.
Yeah. Just trust somebody I don't know who's going to get me a mascot costume. Yeah.
And you trust him because he's Bunkus's nemesis as well.
Oh, is he?
His social media nemesis.
Yeah. Oh, is he? Well, then he's a good person.
I know. I thought that would warm your heart.
That does indeed warm my heart. Anyhow, there you go. Sportsnet.ca/590 for further contest details. They got to do that for slow pitch. That's all I'm asking. They got to do it for slow pitch because I think I can arrange Barker to be a ringer for the team or something like that. Yeah, or get Barker.
Wouldn't that
involved.
Be great? He would be the greatest slow pitch hitter in history, wouldn't he? I know he could also, you know, like I'm not diminishing his.
He's told me he's
skills, but
he struggled at times.
Really?
Yeah. He needs. I think he needs a little more velo coming in. You know.
But he does all that stuff where he, you know, makes those noises and pumps up his biceps and all that stuff. That seems like a slow pitch kind of thing to me.
That's just for show. The Tampa Bay Rays are now up 10-3 on the Houston Astros. The Cardinals are leading the Braves 3-1. They have 2 on in the 4th inning.
Future Blue Jay Marcelo Ozuna's got 2 home runs today.
Future Blue Jay Marcelo Ozuna, who had a horrible September and has come around and is hugely important to that team because if he's not going, then you can go right at Paul Goldschmidt. It's a different lineup completely. A much more difficult lineup to pitch
to. He's making himself
some money as well. Cliff Floyd is our MLB analyst on Sportsnet and the MLB Network, and he joins us in primetime. Good afternoon, Mr. Floyd.
What's going on, fellas? How y'all feeling today?
Feeling pretty good watching Marcelo Ozuna, as Mr. Brunt said, make some money. But before we talk about that, Sir Cliff, I gotta ask you about Tampa Bay and Houston. Now, look, Houston's still going to be the favorites here. There's no doubt about it. But I almost got the impression that watching Houston today, it's like they were done in by the monster they created, right? Because they essentially breathed life into Charlie Morton's career. And Charlie Morton, very few teams have made the Astros look as bad as Charlie Morton made them look today.
No, you're right. And, you know, when you know too much, it can hurt you. You know, when you know tendencies and you've seen this dude go out there and be dominant and kind of know what philosophy they preaching over there in Houston, they probably had everything that they thought. And when you're a good pitcher with poise, as Charlie Morton is, he probably went against the grain.
Mm.
And you watching, you know, him go about his business, right man, right situation. And I think when you saw him pitch in a wild card game, they were able to get out of situations that a young guy, when you saw Sean Manaea on the flip side with Oakland, couldn't get out of his own way.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Charlie is so good and so ready for the moment and has pitched in big moments that nothing phases him. And I just thought he did a tremendous job today.
You know, it's really interesting what you brought up there, though, Cliff, that idea, because like, these guys, you know, Houston are the data kings, obviously. They've got, you know, they're the kings of analytics. But, you know, you also got a guy who, in theory, you would know everything about him. You know everything about this guy. And that could,
yeah.
You know, if the pitcher's smart enough that can work, you know, that you can make that almost work against them, that you could play against tendency in some way that you could fool them. You know, it's amazing that, you know, again, he just pitched really well too. So that's, maybe it's as straightforward as that. But the idea that you could do anything as Charlie Morton against the Houston Astros that would surprise them, like that, you know, that seems to kind of go against logic, but I get what you're saying.
Yeah, sometimes you have to trust your gut and forget about these percentages and analytics. And when your back is against a wall and you face two absolute dominant dudes in Verlander and Cole, you look forward to going, look, y'all do something different in your hitters meeting, and we're going to do something different in our pitchers meeting, right? Like, mm-hmm. But you got to flip the script. They know exactly what you're doing. Everything we've talked about on the network, everything you guys see, everything that's talked about today is, well, he used his fastball 35% more than he did in regular season. Like, uncle sometimes on this stuff, right? And you have to make me think in the box. When I'm walking up from the on-deck circle to the box, I have to be thinking about something totally different than what that paper just showed me that your tendencies are. And when you're a good pitcher, and I'm put Charlie Morton in the top tier in the game, then you can make these adjustments, keep your boys in the ball game, allow them to go out there and destroy Zach Greinke and put some runs on the board, and then everybody can relax and you can get back in the series a little bit.
Cliff, the Astros are still going to be favored to win this series. The Yankees look well. The Yankees are frankly look like they're toying with the Twins. It'll be interesting to see what happens when they go back when they go to Target Field. But let me ask you this: Did Houston see anything out of Zach Greinke today that would make them think twice about starting him against the Yankees?
JB, that's a great question. I mean, you know, we all know Zach Greinke is featuring these days. And if there's one thing you can't do against the Yankees is you can't mess around. You can't just throw balls off the ball. You've seen a team that I thought, of all the teams in the postseason that give any team problems, it was the Minnesota Twins. And they go, well, why you see that? Well, you know, I didn't necessarily look at their rotation and go, they would be outstanding against the Yankees. I looked at their hitters and go, they'll keep them in the ball games, and then possibly you might be able to steal one. Well, you can't go freaking 3-2 to every dude in the Yankees lineup and think you're going to get away and make mental mistakes on defense as well. So to answer the question direct, if Greinke goes and is down in the zone, or you think he can be down in the zone, you think he can make some corrections to some of the things he did today, then yeah, but that's the reason you wouldn't got him at the deadline.
Right.
He extends your rotation to take the pressure off everybody else. I think he's going to be in the Hall of Fame. I really do. Numbers are you know, you can't take them away. They facts. But I think in this situation, you have to be really careful with how you go about your rotation against a team like the Yankees, because they're just a scary offense that does not chase as much as you think they do.
Yeah. Like, I think you've got to pitch them, though, don't you? Like, you.
Yeah, I guess what I was wondering is,
you have to pitch them.
I mean, if I'm the Astros and I'm up 2-0 because Cole and Verlander have been great, then, you know, the decision is made for me. But I guess what I was thinking, if, you know, again, the Astros are creative, and if it's 1-1, you know, maybe you start Greinke, but you have somebody else ready. You know, I don't know, maybe, well, I was going to say you start Wade Miley. You wouldn't do that, but I'm just wondering if A.J. Hinch may not sort of retreat to his lair with his analytics folks and say, let's come up with plan B just in case.
Well, you got to have plan B ready for any situation.
Yeah.
And so that's why when you talk about so many different scenarios, plan B is not sitting in your back pocket. Plan B is out in the front. and guys are in the bullpen with their shoelaces tied and their jackets off. Mm-hmm. Like, that's plan B for me. Like, everybody's in the bullpen at the first pitch of the game. That's plan B, because we're watching four-hour games based on – I hate to use the word scared pitchers. I hate that. But when you're sitting there watching the game, you tend to lean towards, are you scared, or are you just thinking they're going to chase because the percentages say they are? This is the postseason. This is not game 150 or game 90. This is the postseason where guys are going – And I use this analogy the other day, and I hope people can understand what I'm saying. Giancarlo Stanton played in, if I'm not mistaken, 17 games this year, mm-hmm. right? And when you get him in the first game against Jose Barrios, if that's your ace from the Twins, Stanton saw 21 pitches in the game. Mm-hmm. 15 were balls.
Yeah.
To me, you're saying this dude has his timing back. You're saying – He's going to, if I throw him a fastball, he's going to absolutely destroy it. You're saying so many things that if your eyeballs are looking and your eyeballs are watching some of the things that you're probably going to see on tape, I would think you would have to say, look, let me just challenge him, because I believe his time is not where it would be normally if he had 150 games played. And I'm just wondering, at what point do you go, okay, I can't throw him a slider anymore because he's not swinging at it? He took 9 sliders.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you have to make adjustments on the fly, or you're going to go home super fast. The first round is literally scary. You're down 2. You go back home. Okay, great. But what gives you any inkling that things change from an offensive side, from a team that feels really good about their chance?
Yeah,
I think it don't.
No, but you know, look, and that's the first. This is the first time we've seen that Yankees lineup really all year, right? That, like, they're intact. They are, and I, like, you can understand the intimidation factor. I get that, but I guess that's why.
Wait, hold on, though.
Yeah.
I don't want to cut you off. Real quick, I want to just give you this to think about.
Yep.
We've seen this is the best thing about the postseason. We see lineups intact. What we thought we was going to see when we saw the teams in spring training, correct?
Correct.
But things have changed. Edwin Encarnacion, he had to go and hit in instructionally and get some at bats. Yeah, he did well in his little simulated game. Okay, great. And he's been hot. I get it. I might throw him 20, you know, curveballs in the dirt because he's absolutely destroying you. But I need to see, can certain guys who haven't played a lot, who haven't balled a lot, I need to see these dudes really do something. And if they do it, I think I'll tip my hat more to them than guys that have been there the whole season. That's why I was trying to go.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Like I guess what I'm saying is I still, you know, again, it could, those, both those series still got a ways to go. And obviously the Rays are winning today and all of that. But
yeah,
I still think the highlight of this postseason is going to be watching Verlander and Cole go against those guys, because I don't think they're going to pitch scared against that lineup. And that'll be fun.
Absolutely not. You 100% know that they ain't going to pitch scared. They have things that other pitchers don't have. And that's back pocket 95 up in the zone. That's the best pitch in the game. You get a guy that's sitting there looking up in the zone and thinking, I got to get this dude up because his curveball bites, his secondary stuff is good. But that fastball is sitting 96, 97 up in the top of the box. That's a swing and miss pitch. We saw that the whole year with Teoscar Hernandez up in TL. It was like, well, what point do you lay off of it? You can't.
Mm-hmm.
I've been there too many times. You can't lay off of it. It's the most important pitch of any pitcher's arsenal. Because you're thinking as a hitter, oh, my God, this is the only chance I get to get this dude, and the ball is by you.
Cliff, we just got a little more than a minute left. I wanted to ask you about Mike Soroka, though, who pitched a terrific game for the Braves yesterday, a rookie from Calgary. What made him so unhittable yesterday?
Man, I just mentioned the secondary stuff. I know we got a short amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, the Braves went in a tremendous situation to be successful, pitching him on the road. His numbers, I do believe in that. The numbers speak to he's comfortable on the road. He spoke to it. He don't even freaking know why. Mm-hmm. But he pitched great. He knows he's up against it with Waino and the crowd. And when he got the feel in the first inning, I said to the boys in the studio, I go, look, it's going to be a long night for the Cardinals. Yeah. I can just see the bite on everything he was throwing. He was in and out the zone. His fastball was good. He looked confident and poised. But when you have confidence come out the fingertips, I don't care how old or whatever, he pitched beyond his years yesterday.
Cliff, appreciate it, man. Thanks so much.
See you, Cliff.
Blues and Leafs tonight. Jeff Merrick will join us. It's Primetime, the Sportsnet Radio and Television Network.
As an unlicensed doctor, we suggest a prescription for one of our shows. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Fake Doctor's Orders. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. This is Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Welcome back to Primetime Sports with Blair and Brunt. Bob Hunter, chairman and interim CEO of the Toronto Wolfpack, will join us in studio at 5:35. Darren Pang, Amy Trask also. A very busy weekend in sports locally and internationally. We mentioned that there is playoff baseball tonight. Currently, the Cardinals and Braves are on Sportsnet. Dodgers and Nationals, game four of that series, 6:30 p.m. on Sportsnet Ontario. Nice to see Russ Martin driving four runs, get a two-run homer and a two-run double last night. Yankees and Twins. Twins looking to stave off elimination. 8 o'clock on Sportsnet 590. The Fan, the Leafs, are back on the ice tonight against the Stanley Cup champion, St. Louis Blues. We will have our Leafs Nation postgame with Stelic and Alberga right after the Yankees and Twins game on Sportsnet 590. The Fan. Our next Sportsnet 590, the Fan Sportsnet game, is a good one. Thursday, the Lightning will be in Toronto to take on the Maple Leafs. We mentioned the Leafs split this weekend, a 4-1 win over the Columbus Blue Jackets, a 6-5 shootout loss to Montreal in which they blew a big lead. Michael Hutchinson in goal for the Toronto Maple Leafs.
Kasperi Kapanen lost his mind, is that
Kasperi
correct?
Kasperi Kapanen. I mean, he lost his mind. He threw a broken stick.
I just know from a distance. I thought that's what it looked like. He lost his mind.
I don't know. I mean, I've seen guys, you know, get upset when their stick breaks and fling it. Just probably not a good thing to.
It's like Roger Clemens throwing a broken bat, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a little more. It was certainly a rush of blood to the head. Having said that, though, there are ample opportunities. I mean, you don't torch a lead like the Leafs had. You just don't. But kudos to Montreal. We talked about the Canadiens a little bit with Ren Lavoie on Friday, and they lack that star power, that star forward. But my goodness, they've got some depth, and they're quick. So kudos to the Canadiens. A tough rebound game for the Leafs tonight against the St. Louis Blues. Let's bring in Jeff Merrick, host of Scotiabank Wednesday Night Hockey, the NHL and Sportsnet 31 Thoughts, and ice surfing. Hello, Mr. Merrick.
Hello. You know what that, just hearing you guys talk about the Kapanen situation, you know what the Kapanen thing I think is a good jump off point for? Mm-hmm. I asked Anthony Stewart this on Hockey Central today. I've asked many hockey players this. Maybe you guys, since you cover more sports than I do, have asked other athletes this question. How many pro athletes do you think know all the rules of their sport?
That's a very good question.
That is a very good question. Having seen some of the confusion on a baseball field around certain places.
Well, remember the playoff game against the Texas Rangers, the deflected ball, right?
And yes,
no one knew what the rule was there, right? No one knew.
Because we all assume that by the time you become a pro athlete in whatever, baseball, hockey, basketball, football, choose your sport, we just assume that, oh, they're a professional player. They must know the rules.
Mm-hmm.
I'm willing to bet the answer is pretty close to 100%. That the athletes don't. I mean, there's confusion. First of all, there's the throwing the stick. Okay, you're not supposed to throw the stick. We've never seen it in that situation. We usually see it on breakaways.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah.
My first thought is, like many, okay, it's a penalty. Uh-oh, Leafs are going to be down 5-3 here. This is tough for them. I didn't know penalty shot in that situation. I just thought, oh, breakaway or empty net, you throw the stick. And all of a sudden, it's a penalty shot. No, I thought minor penalty at first. So, like, I'm not putting myself on any type of pedestal here and saying that I know the entire rule book, even though one of the things I do at the beginning of every season is, you know, at least have a peek at the rule book, specifically about the changes. But I don't know. I'd be very curious.
Blair and I read the whole thing before every season, Jeff. So,
To the point where I'm going to make it a point now, whenever I talk to athletes, certainly casually and maybe formally as well, I'm going to ask them, how much do you know the rules of your sport? Because we just assume that they do, but more and more, the deeper I get into this goofy career, I realize they don't, guys.
So I'll tell you,
so you've never seen that before. I just want to, because again, I was watching this from a distance. I'm following this, and I was thinking the same thing. The thing I know is that if you throw a stick and impede a breakaway, it's a penalty shot. That does happen, but I've never seen this before.
I've never seen a broken stick be thrown and discarded off to the corner, into the boards.
Mm-hmm.
We can all recall a very famous event at Air Canada Cinema, one guy got sucked up into the stands.
Yep.
But no, I've never seen a player throw a stick at an opponent on the blue line while killing a penalty to try to stop a shot. No, I've never seen that.
Yeah, that is, and it's something I presume Kasperi Kapanen will not do again.
Yes.
It's a teachable moment. The interesting thing about it is that, I mean, many of us, and I counted myself as one of them, guys, I didn't think Kapanen was going to see another shift.
Oh, fair point,
But there he was, back on the ice. I didn't think Kasperi Kapanen would be back on that top line. But guess what? He'll be there again tonight.
I guess it kind of gets lost a little bit in the storylines of that game. It was such a good comeback by the Montreal Canadiens. And again, credit to the Canadiens for that.
Yeah.
But, Jeff, did Michael Hutchinson show you enough? One game, I get that. Did he show you enough as a backup goaltender to change your mind or to enforce your opinion?
No, but at the same time, I'll say that, Carey Price, in the 65 minutes of play, let in the exact same number of goals.
Mm-hmm.
If I want to look at it just cynically, I'd say, well, hold on a second here, Hutchinson let in five and so did Carey Price. But you look at the body of work of both, and it's, of course, completely different. So far, no. But, I think the Maple Leafs have their fingers crossed that he's going to be the guy. But so far, that's just his first day out. We haven't seen any indication that he's going to be able to lug it over the long haul here, no.
You mentioned Kapanen's continued presence there in that game and tonight. He's obviously a placeholder, right, till Hyman comes back. But what would be if they choose to make a move there before Hyman comes back? How does the shuffle work in your opinion?
You know what? I think a lot of people are really impressed with Ilya Mikheyev and what he's been able to bring. Not just 5-on-5, but on the penalty kill as well. That entire third line, by the way, with Kerfoot and Moore, has been exceptional. It wouldn't surprise me if they were to make a shuffle. It would be a simple left-wing swap-out for Mikheyev for Kapanen. I don't think you want to touch the Matthews, Andreas Johnsson, William Nylander line. You would imagine that, once players start to come back, that Kasperi Kapanen will find his way onto that third line eventually anyhow, and then they'll need to find a new spot for Mikheyev. So that, to me, would be the easy swap, Stephen.
Yeah, it might be worth, even just for a look-see, wouldn't it? Like, it kind of makes sense to just, kind of confirm what your eyes are telling you about him, right?
Yeah.
Put him in that situation.
Yeah, one of the things, and I thought about this a lot, because Saturday was such a freak night for the Maple Leafs with goofy things happening and unexpected, perhaps, lineup decisions being made. And that's been the story of the Maple Leafs season so far, going back to opening night against Ottawa. I wonder if this is a situation where Mike Babcock says, everybody expects me to bench Kapanen, so I'm not going to do it. Everybody expects me to take Kapanen off the line, so I'm not going to do it. There is very much a feeling, and maybe this plays into the Jason Spezza situation as well. There is a feeling that if Mike Babcock feels he's on the hot seat, if they fail in the first round, it's going to be hung on him. And Sheldon Keefe waits at Rico Coliseum with the Marlies. There is a feeling that more so than ever, we're going to see Mike Babcock do things that reinforce the idea that if he's going out, he's doing it his way and he's doing it with his guys.
Thank God, because
it's going to be a fascinating season, boys.
Oh, it's going to be interesting. I mean, we're going to have to get those Mike Babcock Dakota rings ready again and to figure out what he really means when he slips into his passive aggressive mode. Hey, I want to change focus a little bit. The Buffalo Sabres have a shot at going. At going 3-0 tonight. They've done it four times in their history. They haven't done it since 2008, 2009. And I mean, I like calling Ralph Kruger the most intriguing man in hockey, the international man of mystery, because he's done stuff in hockey, he's done stuff in soccer and all that. But I keep thinking back to a comment Ryan Nugent-Hopkins made about a year after he was fired, Jeff. And I think we may have spoken about that when Ryan Nugent-Hopkins said, you know, looking back on it, I kind of wish we'd paid more attention to what Ralph was talking about and had done better for him, because I think it really would have been fun to play for him. I'm fascinated in seeing what will happen in Buffalo with him this year.
Same. And Elliot and I talked to Jack Eichel in Chicago at the NHL Media Tour. And I think cult leader is too strong a term, but I think you know what I'm winking at here.
Mm-hmm.
Like Jack Eichel talked about, you know, meeting Ralph Krueger for dinner. I think it might have been Switzerland, and it was only supposed to be, you know, an hour or an hour and a half chat, turned into all night long. He said, we talked a little bit about hockey, but we talked a lot about life, and we talked about rock and roll, and we talked about, and the more that he started to talk about Krueger, it seemed like this guy is not just a hockey coach. It's almost as if he's a life coach. And we've seen coaches like this before, and you guys have seen it in plenty of sports. We don't get it so much in hockey, although there have been some in the past. But if you talk to players on that Buffalo Sabre squad, like, they sound a lot like Jack Eichel when they talk about Ralph Krueger. And he's done some interesting things already. The most notable is splitting up Jack Eichel and Jeff Skinner to spread out the offense a little bit more. And Victor Olofsson slides up to that top line left wing spot where he's looked really good so far. And here's a guy who was a late round draft pick who's worked his way into the lineup in a prominent position. But that couldn't have been an easy decision. I mean, here's Jeff Skinner, you know, career season playing with Jack Eichel. It seemed like, guys, that would be the 2-foot putt of all time. You keep these two guys together. But he's split them up, and I know it's an audit of only a couple of games here, but so far so good for the Buffalo Sabres. I know there's a lot of heavy lifting still to come and a lot of hockey to play, and just because you're successful for a week or a couple of weeks doesn't mean you're going to be successful for the entire season. But so far, you know, Ralph Krueger has really struck a chord with a lot of these guys, and he's doing it in an environment where he's making some really difficult choices that if you're not a popular guy with the players, it might be tough to survive.
Yeah, that's a great point.
That is a great point.
You know, it is, and it is, look, it is a place, an organization where, like, they, you know, a bold move was in order, wasn't it? Right? Like you might as well, right? Like, you know, like they've, it has been hard to make those pieces fit. They have some pieces, but it's been a challenge, hasn't it?
It's been tough, and, you know, everything gets compounded when you make a deal like the Ryan O'Reilly trade, and 1 year later, he's got the Conn Smythe Trophy, and he's won the Stanley Cup.
Yeah.
And you look at the roster tonight against Columbus, and you will not see one piece from the Ryan O'Reilly trade in that lineup for the Buffalo Sabres. So that one really stings. You know, you look at the entire lineup, and you say to yourself, you know, Casey Mittelstadt's still there. Did we make a mistake by playing him in the NHL all season long? What did we do with the O'Reilly trade? Did we overvalue someone like Tage Thompson? Did we think he was going to be something that he's really not? You know, what are we doing here? We've got Okposo and Gergensen's on the fourth line. What happened there? Like, there's but to me, Buffalo is a fascinating team, and you want them to be really good because, listen, the owner is a wonderful hockey person. We can all remember the initial press conference, you know, him crying at the sight of Gilbert Perreault, and, you know, talking about the French connection and bringing some of that glory back to Buffalo. And even just selfishly, as someone that's a Toronto sports fan, I mean, as much as we talk about, you know, the game we just saw on Saturday between the Montreal Canadiens and Toronto Maple Leafs, and sometimes it's special when Ottawa and Toronto mixes. I mean, you guys remember the Don Edwards versus Mike Palmatier, Daryl Sittler versus French Connection QEW rivalry. I mean, that's another one that we're waiting to finally see hit a crescendo. And now this time around, it'll be, you know, Jack Eichel versus Austin Matthews, you know, two of the top American-born centermen in the NHL. It'll be Mike Babcock versus the team he said no to. This will be, I mean, there are so many different sidebar stories to all of it. You're waiting for that to finally actualize, but there's still a lot that needs to be done with this Buffalo Sabres roster till we come even close to even, you know, whispering something like that.
Just while we got here, Jeff, and we do, you know, since the Blues are in town tonight for their like, it's hard to repeat. It's almost impossible to repeat, but yep, very hard to repeat because just in part just because of how much hockey you have to play to win the cup. But you know what? If you played out there 2018, 2019 season 1,000 times, it would never play out the same way, right? Like that's a crazy, crazy series of events that led to them winning the cup. And how do you follow that? Like, where are you emotionally if you're that team going into this season, starting afresh as the defending Stanley Cup champion?
I think you say to yourself, you know, we went from, you know, adversity to where we couldn't win a game to where, you know, literally, you know, Sanford and Bartuzzo were having fights on the ice in practice and had to be separated. We had a coach dismissal, couldn't stop a puck, couldn't put a cup. I mean, I remember Stephen last year talking to people who said they couldn't believe what they were hearing on the bench during games. Like, that's how dysfunctional it was. And, you know, in comes Craig Berube, the assistant coach. And that's another part of this. It is very seldom where an assistant coach turns into the head coach and is successful.
Mm-hmm.
Because the personality has, you guys know this, the personality has to change. And sometimes players look at you like you're a fraud. This guy who's bag skating me now, you know, 2 weeks ago when he was assistant coach, was inviting me and my wife over for barbecues. What has changed here now in this person? And then they got the goaltender, and all of a sudden everything changes when you get a save. I think if you're the St. Louis Blues, you look at it as a team and you say, you know what? We went through hell last season. It was awful. We were the worst team in the NHL, and we crawled our way out of it. So I think if you're a team like the St. Louis Blues and you're playing in, no, Stephen, you're probably playing in the toughest division of all of hockey. You can make the argument for five, and maybe if you squint hard enough, six teams to win the Stanley Cup this season. If anyone's going to do it, we've done it before, and we can do it again because there's a never-say-quit attitude amongst the St. Louis Blues. Now, you're right. Like, everything had to fall in line. Like, everything had to be perfect. O'Reilly had to be that guy. Schwartz had to be that guy. You needed to get, you know, great performances from Sammy Blais. You need to get, you know, great performances down the roster from your Barbashevs and your Sundquist and your Steens. Your defense had me. You got found money in someone like Vince Dunn, who would be playing up in the lineup if he was playing on any other team, but he's playing a bottom-pairing role on the St. Louis Blues, and you have the goaltender. And, man, so many of your mistakes can be covered up with a simple save. And we've talked about it before. If you have a goalie, it's 70% of your team. If you don't, it's 100. And if you're the St. Louis Blues, you say, sure, we faced it before. Sure, we're in the most competitive division in all of hockey. But after what we just went through, nothing's going to hurt us now.
Yeah, and I also like the fact that in bringing in a guy like Justin Falk, you know, you've done something that successful franchises in every sport do. They refresh themselves, right? You stick with the core,
yeah.
But it never hurts to bring in somebody else who's going to change the dynamic a bit, maybe bring a little different feel to things. And I think it was such a smart acquisition for them.
And you know what it does? It insulates you in case Alex Pietrangelo decides to leave.
Sure.
I mean, Justin Falk's right side D, much like Colton Parayko. If they can, you know, do something, Alex Pietrangelo, to keep the captain in the mix, I'm sure Doug Armstrong will do it. Elliot Friedman reporting on the weekend on headlines on Hockey Night that, listen, we all know Newport's office is down the street in Mississauga. St. Louis Blues are in town. His representation meeting with the St. Louis Blues to see if those talks can get going. But if it ends up going nowhere and Alex Pietrangelo ends up going somewhere else, you bring in someone like Falk, who's 2 years younger than Pietrangelo. You've got Colton Parayko, who's 26 years old. You know, a really big, strong. I mean, their right side is still fine should Alex Pietrangelo leave the mix. So they're right now, the St. Louis Blues are going for it again. They're reloading, and they're also insulating themselves for the future as well.
Jeff, how concerned should the Pittsburgh Penguins be about Evgeny Malkin's situation right now? I mean, according to Mike Sullivan, his season is not in jeopardy, but they are saying it's a long-term or a longer-term injury. I mean, you see the hit. It looks ugly. Yep. What happens to them if Evgeny Malkin is out for a couple of months?
Get a steady diet of Jared McCann. It's your second line center. And we've always said about the Pittsburgh Penguins, as long as you have Crosby and Malkin, you're always in consideration for not just the playoffs, but the Stanley Cup. And if Malkin has gone long-term, I love Sidney Crosby. We all do. We think that he's the most, you know, remarkable athlete in hockey in this generation, but there's only so much that one player can do. You've already made the move with Phil Kessel in the offseason. You know, your defense isn't anything to write about. You've been trying to move Jack Johnson for a long time. So from Sidney Crosby to Evgeny Malkin, now you go Sidney Crosby to Jared McCann and Teddy Bluger. Like, it gets real tough. But the thing about Pittsburgh is that you guys know Jim Rutherford. This isn't a general manager that sits on his hands.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, this is a general manager that isn't shy about the aggressive move, the big move, the shakeup move. And I wouldn't be surprised to see Jim Rutherford get to action right away. Because the interesting thing about where Pittsburgh Penguins find themselves, unlike the Central that we just talked about, if you look at the Metropolitan Division, outside of the Washington Capitals, who I still think are a legit Stanley Cup contender and an excellent hockey team, you can make the case for everybody. Much like you can make the case for everybody in the Central making the playoffs, you can make the case for everybody in the Metro outside of Washington missing the playoffs.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that includes the Pittsburgh Penguins. It is jump ball in the Metro right now. That's why if you're the Penguins and Jim Rutherford, you say, we can't have Malkin out for this long because this may end up costing us a playoff spot, and it should be easier than ever in the Metropolitan to make the postseason.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I don't. They're not a playoff team without Malkin, I don't think.
But I'm with you.
I don't know what Rutherford wheels here, though, Jeff. That's the other thing. You know, what are the assets he can wheel? I think you're right. He tries to shake things up, but he's not dealing from a great hand right now.
No, and he's been trying to move Jack Johnson, and that's the one piece. And there's been no takers.
Yeah.
And he's 3.25 for another, I want to say, 3 years. So maybe it's not the money, but it's the term on Jack Johnson that will scare teams away. And there's only so long you can continue to chew into your future by trading first-round picks. Like, how long can you do that? Do you make a move with one of the defensemen outside of Jack Johnson? Well, then you're all of a sudden turning to your Chad Ruweedles and your Juuso Ricolas, and all of a sudden you've devalued your blue line. No matter how you cut it, like I'm with you, Steven, this is a really tough situation for the Penguins and an unenviable spot right now for Jim Rutherford.
One of the things that happened this weekend, Barry Trotz, I did not realize this, coached his 1,608th regular season game past Al Arbor for third most in NHL history. It's when the Islanders beat the Jets 4-1 at Nassau Coliseum. Barry Trotz has quietly had an intriguing career, hasn't he?
Yeah. Nashville, and he helped them rise and then into the Washington Capitals and got over that hump that coaches like Bruce Boudreau and Adam Oates and Dale Hunter and before that Glenn Hand, like coaches couldn't get them to that spot. Like to me, and he's not a big, like he's not a larger than life personality. He's a defenseman from the Regina Pack. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a fire hydrant of a tough defenseman that played in the Western Hockey League and made his way through the ranks honestly and earned everything he's been given. He's never been one to put himself out in front of his team. And honestly, I think one of the reasons why a stat like that might be shocking is because he was in Nashville for so long.
Yeah.
And Nashville's different now. Nashville, like Peter Laviolette, everyone knows about Peter Laviolette in Nashville, and everyone knows about the Nashville Predators. But it was Barry Trotz that got them there. Right? That they became the Nashville Predators under Barry Trotz, but they existed in almost anonymity for a number of years while they were a really good team, while they were a goaltending factory for the rest of the NHL, while they were a defenseman factory and still are for the rest of the NHL. The one constant to all, well, the two, David Poile and their head coach, Barry Trotz. He's done, you know, very quietly a remarkable job, and he's done it without being a self-promoter at all.
Mm. Yeah,
we all know the coaches that are the self-promoters, and Barry Trotz ain't one of those guys.
Well, and he inspires a lot of loyalty because of that, I think.
I'm with you.
You talk to guys who play for him, and I think that's part of the reason, is that he, you know, he's not, self-effacing is the wrong word, but he's not the show, and I think players appreciate that.
He's never been a we win, they lose
yes
kind of guy. It's always, and you know what I'm talking about? I mean, he's always, and he's taken bullets for his players. Like, he's gone out there and held court while the guys can escape before the microphones show up after a bad night. Players recognize that. And you know what? At the end of it all, too, he's a really fair guy, and he's an honest guy.
Yeah.
And I'm biased because I think he's a wonderful coach. I think he's a really solid human being, and his family story, if you know anything about, you know, him and his child, I mean, he is a salt of the earth person on top of already being an outstanding NHL coach.
Good stuff as always, Mr. Merrick. We're going to let you scoot. Thanks for doing this, man.
Thanks, boys. Do players know the rules? That's the question.
I'm gonna ask everybody that now from now on. That's a good, no, it's a great question. And I might ask some coaches if they know the rules too.
A good one. Yeah, why not? Or referees for that matter.
Absolutely. Take care, Jeff. Jeff Merrick of the NHL and Sportsnet. If you're interested, by the way, Joel Quenneville, who is coaching the Florida Panthers, is 1,638 games, so he's second the great Scotty Bowman, 2,141 games coached in the NHL. I don't imagine anybody's going to get that. Paul Maurice, this is actually kind of fascinating. Paul Maurice, 1,532, sixth most in the NHL behind Ken Hitchcock at 1,598. So there they go. But yeah, Barry Trotz is, I mean, I covered Barry Trotz when he was a defenseman with the University of Manitoba Bisons. And his path to getting to where he is has been remarkable.
Yep.
It really has been.
Yeah, most of what I know about him on that side, I know through Jordan Tutu, you know, who I worked with on his book and
yeah.
got to know. And you know, Jordan was going through some stuff when he was in Nashville, mm-hmm. to say the least, you know, and that organization, but especially Poile and Trotz, really, you know, they were good human beings
yep.
through that stuff. And, you know, it's good to hear that about people.
Yeah, he is a very, I mean, I've dealt with him a little bit, you know, in my previous job. And when I covered hockey a little bit, he was a very, the word that always comes to mind is sincere. Like you always got the impression when you were interviewing him that he was answering you just honestly and sincerely. And you know, and again, to hang around that long, to coach that long. Now, granted, his record isn't bad. He's got, 811, 596. He's got 214 more wins than losses. That'll keep you in the league a long time if mm-hmm. you do that. But if you look at the teams he's coached, the players he's coached, the success he's had, the different situations he's had, it's pretty good. And he's, you know, I just think it's kind of neat that you pass Al Arbor while you're coaching the Islanders at Nassau Coliseum. The Atlanta Braves are now leading the Cardinals 4-3 in the top of the sixth inning. The Braves would win the series with a win, which would mean that Alex Anthopoulos, Josh Donaldson, and Mike Soroka would be off to the National League Division Series. We mentioned that the Tampa Bay Rays had their way with the Houston Astros 10-3. The Astros have just announced that Justin Verlander will start game four in short rest, so they're not fooling around.
Nope.
I don't know how much of a surprise that was, but they're definitely not fooling around.
Can you win a World Series with those two horses?
Yes.
In the old days, you could.
You got it. This is why I asked Cliff about Zach Greinke. I think you can. I think you can win with those two guys. And the Astros bullpen is not the worst bullpen in baseball. But you need somebody to be this year's Lance McCullers or yeah. Colin McHugh. You need somebody to just surprise you.
Yeah, and it only has to be for three starts, probably.
Yeah, and right? Maybe that guy is Wade Miley. Maybe it's, you know, maybe it is Zach Greinke. But man, oh man, you know, the knock against Zach Greinke. I mean, he's the active leader among starting pitchers in games pitched in without going to the World Series. And the knock against him is,
the bigger the game, yeah. the bigger the stage, the worse he gets.
Sometimes he spits out the bit.
Yep.
And that will not change as a result of what happened against Tampa Bay. Right. But again, it's the next.
How's he going to like Yankee Stadium?
Well,
again, I think that's just assuming that's where we're headed here.
Yeah. And that presents an interesting situation for
yes,
Houston because you've got home field, right?
That's
so
correct.
You're going to play 3 and 4 at Yankee Stadium.
Yes, you are.
You know, it'll be interesting to see how they manage that.
Probably depends on how hard they have to ride Verlander and Cole to get through this series. And maybe, you know, you say, well, we'll start Zach Greinke in game one or game two at home if you have to ride these guys really hard to get through this division.
I'll tell you what, that was certainly a sign of respect that you're running Justin Verlander out on short rest against Tampa. You do not want to fool around. You do not want to let the Rays back in it. The million-pound game was held this weekend, or the million-pound match. I guess they call it the million-pound game. The Toronto Wolfpack beat Featherstone Rovers 24-6 on Saturday. They are off to the Super League, which is the Premier League rugby league. And Bob Hunter, their chairman and interim CEO, was in studio before the million-pound game. And since they won, we decided we'd invite him back.
Clearly, we're a good luck charm.
We are good luck charm.
Not that they needed a lot of good luck this year. They only lost, two matches the whole year?
Yes. And this is an intriguing sports story just because of the whole transatlantic nature of the league and the transatlantic nature of this endeavor. Bob Hunter, chairman and CEO of the Wolfpack, will join us in studio. It's Primetime Sports with Blair and Brunt on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Good show. Good Podcast. Subscribe to podcasts of Good Show at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Now back to Primetime Sports on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
All right, welcome back to Primetime Sports. We got a trophy here.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
I've never won anything before. That's not true. There you go. We've got a trophy here. Bob Hunter is the chairman and interim CEO of the Toronto Wolfpack. Congratulations on your win in the million-pound game and advancing to the Super League. This is a heavy trophy, by the way. We just carried it up here
from our office.
So you understand how heavy it is. This is quite a coup, isn't it?
It is. I think, honestly, just the fever that was in the building on the weekend.
Can you just lean into your microphone a little bit?
Commissioner
Thanks,
from the Rugby League was there. Mayor was there. I'd say we had close to 10 or 11,000 fans. It was just magic. And finally, we got there after last year's loss.
Yeah, that's it, right? Because, you know, we kind of thought we'd be in this position a year ago, right? And you guys thought, what did that extra year, what did that mean in terms of the development of this, you know, again, the development of the franchise and you know, especially kind of developing the fan base in the city, you know, because you did kind of, you know, people anticipated that. They could have rightly anticipated last year. It was disappointing when you guys lost the million-pound game. But what did that extra year do, Bob?
Well, I think certainly from the squad standpoint, and improve the level of play. I mean, somewhat embarrassingly to go 27-1 in the season, but we just had a really strong group of guys. And, you know, Brian Noble, our director of rugby, is an exceptional evaluator of talent. And Brian McDermott is an exceptional coach who came from Super League. So I think those guys from the get-go in the start of the year said, you know what, we're going to make a difference and we're going to make a mark. And thank God they did it.
Now, in terms of, you know, the leap you're about to make in terms of the level of play, now that, you know, and again, the side you guys beat in the million-pound game is not, it's not typical of that league, but it's, you know, they're not fully professional, right? There's some part-time players in that game. You guys are fully professional, but you're going up into a different level, which is, you know, not just fully professional, but, you know, the elite players in this version of the sport. What's that mean in terms of, I know you know, the Wolfpack have gone out and invested in lots of talent, but where does your payroll go now compared to where it will be in Super League? How much more of an investment is it?
Well, certainly from the standpoint of what we think the squad will look like next year, again, the coach has suggested we're four or five guys away from being strongly competitive in that league. And again, because both Bryans were in that league, they have a great appreciation. The game is quicker, faster, and it's tougher because the guys are bigger, and you're right, they're all professionals. And so we think we'll be ready, but we won't see till we get to the competition. And so there will be some changes.
What's the first thing now that you beat Featherstone 24-6, you've advanced to Super League, what's the first thing you have to do now? Like, what is the next step for you guys in terms of planning for next year?
Well, I think, again, because of the arrangements we had at the championship league level, I think we're going to be fine as it relates to sort of the logistics, the planning, the whatever. I mean, for us, it's a matter of how much more we can sell being at a higher level in the league. So from ticket sales to sponsorship to merchandise, et cetera, it's trying to make the operation more commercially viable. But also, I mean, we're going into a new family of 11 professional teams, and I think certainly from my standpoint, we've got a lot to learn from them. And we start tomorrow night when I leave for the UK for a week. So
now this changes. Like the Super League schedule starts in February, right?
Yes.
So this is going to be – so we have a different calendar now. What's that – I think we talked a little bit about this the last time you were in here, Bob, kind of speculatively. But what does that do in terms of home and away matches for you guys?
Well, probably the first – three or four games, we call them home but aways.
So you're going to play. So they will be technically home games, but you're going to play them across the
ocean. Correct. And what we've agreed with the Super League is that, as strange as the place we may want to take them, as you know, Copenhagen or even to Florida or whatever, is that the other team has to agree to that location. And I think again, those are discussions that will start right away because the schedule comes out in November. So those three or four games we made do a doubleheader with one of the Super League clubs, keep them in interested rugby markets, that sort of thing. But also, we think it's good to spread rugby league and around the world. So that's
so you treat them as kind of maybe as one-offs in certain places.
Absolutely.
Okay.
What do you have to do to convince your partners that you guys aren't going to be more trouble than you're worth? Because it sounds like they're going to. Sounds like there's going to be a lot of. No, there's going to have to be a certain amount of flexibility here on the part of your partners, isn't there?
Well, yeah. You know, I think it's a matter. Honestly, it's going to get down to trust, and we're going to be over there a lot this year because we want to truly show our commitment, our participation. I think we've going to be able to show them that we've got a solid business plan and we've got long-term financial stability. I think it's really a matter of them trying to figure out what we are and vice versa. And I think I'm totally confident that we can do that.
So what's now explain the Bob, the television situation here, because they do have a deal with Sky in the UK. But that you guys don't get cut in on that deal and those games will not be shown here. You don't have a television deal per se. And I know the content deals are different now than they once were. We're not talking about, you know, straight rights deals are not necessarily the norm, but you guys don't get the proceeds of that Sky deal the first year anyway. And I presume you're going to be looking for some kind of a broadcast arrangement in North America, right?
Well, that is the intent. We hope that the league will look at it as unused inventory that we might be able to take advantage of, both North American distribution and even other markets where they haven't sold the rights away. So again, we think that and there are other commercial opportunities where we think we can make up the difference between that the non-participation element of certainly going into the league at this point.
Because it's a pretty good, like the Sky deal is reasonably lucrative, right? Like per team, it's what, a couple million, is it £2 million a year or $2 million a year?
It's £2 to £2.4 million a year.
Yeah, so wow. That's significant, right?
Very significant.
It'd be tough to make that up elsewhere. Now, why are you guys not cut in on that as a member of the league?
I think it was sort of the arrangement that when we came into the league originally. So we've never participated in distribution. The League One is a small number. Championship is actually a more significant number, but Super League is a big number. So certainly from the standpoint of trying to convince our owners have the right to belong there is a matter of trying to convince them at some point that we're part of the family and that should be equally distributed.
Because that would change, you know, that would drastically change the economics of the franchise, wouldn't it?
Oh, dramatically.
Yeah.
Yes, dramatically.
But it's, you know, because there's one fewer piece of the pie coming out. So everybody, I'm presuming the other teams, because they don't have to cut you in, are all going to get a little more this year. They're probably thrilled about that. But I can't think of an equivalent of this. Let's put it, there's no equivalent to this whole story. But yeah, the fact that, you know, generally television rights are shared among because you're playing the games, you're creating part of the content, right?
Well, absolutely. And you know, the uniqueness of Toronto being in the league, and we certainly saw it in Championship, is we're a bit of a unique product and people will actually, we know attendance was stronger in other cities in the UK and in France when we played. So attendance was up. So we're hoping that we can prove that again to the Super League clubs that, you know, your poor cousin in North America actually deserves to be part of the family.
And then, so is that, that will be a discussion again after this year? Is that the theory?
Well, we have a 12-month review that we can do with it. They can, you know, it's a negotiation. And again, we hope that everything being fair and equitable will be treated as part of the family.
We're in conversation with Wolfpack Chairman Bob Hunter. I read to you when you came in an article in The Guardian where it referred to and antagonism in the northern towns towards the Toronto Wolfpack. And Stephen talked about this a little bit at the start of the show.
Yeah,
about,
it's a provincial, you know, like with the exception of the French team and the Catalan team they had, it's the most provincial of sports, isn't it? It's not just an English sport. It's a chunk of England that it comes from.
It's a very, very ardent fan base in the north of England, focused and centered around Manchester. And without a doubt, I mean, I was joking with one of the Featherstone fans on the weekend. I said, so how big is Featherstone? He said, Bob, it's a village. It's a village. He did admit it was 10 or 12,000 people. But yes, no, they are and passionate rugby league followers. And so I don't know if because we manhandled most teams this year in championship level that that antagonism was created. We've certainly not felt it as we've talked to the Super League owners yet. So we'll see what happens. But I was a bit surprised by that comment.
I'm wondering if that's, you know, the other league, rugby league hotbed in the world really is Australia, right? That's, you know, the National Rugby League there. Is there any market for the content because of the flipped seasons? Would there be any market for the television content there?
We don't know that. But again, that's one of the opportunities that we will look at because, you know, again, because we have so many international players, you know, some of the best players in the Super League are New Zealand or Australians.
Mm-hmm.
So
what's been the most surprising thing for you about this since you took on this endeavor? Now that the Wolfpack have won the trophy, has anything surprised you about this that maybe you weren't prepared for?
No, I don't think so. Again, I think I mentioned previously when I was here that sports is sports and it's the same sort of business. The one thing that's been very interesting is the access to the players is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Like these guys are just regular guys. They're happy to be playing professional sports. And our community people are always surprised at how readily available they are to go out into the community. So, and even the guys today, most of them were packing up to fly home tonight. I mean, they're just such down-to-earth blokes that they're just happy to be in, and they love Toronto.
So how many home games will you have next year? How many games in Toronto, not home games other places?
Either 10 or 11.
10 or 11.
Minimum 10. We might be able to work in 11.
That's probably, in terms of inventory, that's probably a pretty good number, right? Like that's,
yes.
You know, that allows you to kind of focus things. Lamport, we've talked about this before, but Lamport is what it is, right? But you've got 10,000 people in there on the weekend, and they were happy to be there, I presume. How's this going to change? How's being in the Super League going to change for fans in Toronto, change things for your supporters in Toronto?
Well, again, I think it's a bigger game and it's a bigger financial package. So we're hoping that we can, over 2 or 3 years, show some significant investment in the building. The mayor did say on Saturday when he was handing out the trophy that, you know, we're going to work to improve this building. So I've already got a phone call into him about that. But it's a matter of it's small stuff. I mean, it's a video board. It's a better sound system. It's just better concessions, better washrooms. I mean, we have to upgrade the locker rooms because our locker rooms are not Super League level locker rooms. So we've got a bit of work to do that we have to do. And then there's a lot of work that we'd love to do.
Mm. You must have been planning for this, you or previous administrations or owners. There had to be some planning in place for this, though, right?
Last year, right?
Because
they thought they were going to be there last
year. Well, yeah. But, I mean, you can't sort of aspire to something and then not be prepared to actually achieve that. Those aspirations, correct? Like some of the stuff I would imagine has already been put in place, has it?
Well, I think from a planning standpoint, yes. I think everybody assumed we were going to be there last year.
Right.
Didn't happen, unfortunately. But I think they were all ready for it. So, you know, our team and they're an amazing bunch of employees, I think logistically are ready to jump up right away. And so that planning has been in place and certainly now is executionable as we move forward, because literally our guys go back to camp in 6 weeks. So it's not a long off season.
What does this mean for the future of rugby league in North America? Because we've talked about other cities being interested now that, I mean, you've shown a lot of cities a way forward, frankly, haven't you? If you're another city interested in getting into this, there is a template here. What does this mean for the sport and this league in North America, do you think?
Well, I think anything that's a continued promotion of what we're all about is beneficial to the sport. You know, we work with the union guys here in the other league. We work with Rugby Canada, and it's just promotion of the game itself that I think is extremely important. We talked earlier about, you know, growing rugby at a junior level and at the community level and building those fans of the future. So all of that is critically important to our success down the road. I think, again, more television, more exposure, more fans in the stands. I mean, it's going to come. I really believe it's going
to
come.
But it'd still be, you know, for anybody to follow this path, it's a leap, right? You would have to start where you guys started. Mm. But because of the travel and logistics and the cost, like it's not, you know, if this was a North American league, you'd have teams popping up left, right, and center, probably, people taking a shot at it. But that's this is not a casual investment.
This is not for the faint at heart.
No.
Let me say that.
No. So do you think, is there any indication right now, Bob, that anybody's toying with the idea of kind of following this path in North America, like, you know, starting in, you know, in the league and working their way up and doing exactly what you guys have done?
Well, again, and it's been publicly stated, both interest has been expressed by Ottawa, and they've been in numerous discussions with the leagues, with the RFL. New York City as well have expressed interest and have had numerous discussions. I couldn't tell you where those stand, but I know that I think we have shown to both the RFL and to the Super League that it is very beneficial to have the amount of international exposure that we've been able to provide. And we hope that they'll look positively on expansion into North America. I couldn't give you a timetable as to when that might happen, but certainly from our standpoint, it would be great.
So they do see this as a net positive. Again, it's kind of hard to, again, the culture of the sport is so different, but you know, from a business standpoint, and even from kind of a culture standpoint, this one team, you know, far away. Sure, they have a team in Toulouse and they have the Catalan team, but this is a whole other kettle of fish. That they do view this as a positive rather than kind of a, you know, an inconvenience of some sort.
Well, certainly the indications, and we met with a number of the bigger clubs when we were over a few weeks ago, was that no, we get it. Like, we understand that this is good for the league because the league was not expanding. The league was not growing. And, you know, again, not faint of heart, but you know, David Argall took the shot to go for it. And it's been a big commitment, certainly on his part. But I think, again, once we get into the league and the Super League sees the benefits of it, I think we're very positive about the future growth.
You talked a little bit, and this may be a question more for Brian Noble, but you talked a little bit about sort of the importance of community to this team, the importance of players being involved in the community. And there will be some turnover, as you mentioned. Are you at all concerned, or are you all cognizant of making sure that regardless of how big you do get, that there is still that connection to the community? Or is that just, Bob, maybe is it the nature of the sport and the athlete that you're never gonna lose that, regardless of how big you get?
Jeff, I think it is the latter, and you probably hit the nail right on the head, is that these guys appreciate, I think, more than any other athletic or sports team I've worked with over my career. They are just so happy to be here and so happy to help out. And they I won't say they come from humble, but it's a blue collar sport,
mm-hmm.
And they're just appreciative of what they have. And you know, guys are quite committed to helping out at that community level whenever we ask.
Well, it's going to be an interesting trek.
Yeah, we've been following this story one way or another since before, you know, but it's pre-beginnings when it was a crazy notion a couple of guys
had. I remember when they came in, and I mean, it's just not going to work that you're going to have guys, you have one team, two teams in another, three teams transatlantic. Okay, I could see it. But I mean, I admit I was a skeptic. There's no way that one team over here, that culturally it's going to work with the other teams. But yeah.
Well,
I'm wrong, man.
I'm there because I think it's just a great opportunity. Great opportunity for Toronto, but also a great opportunity for rugby league.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. You know, knowing just a little bit, as I said, about how serious the sport is taken in the north, in the north of England. It'll be fun to see. And hopefully we get some of the fans, hopefully you get some fans coming over here too, which would
be interesting. One last comment is that, you know, the rugby league or Super League fans travel with their teams, and we anticipate, and we've been told this by almost every team we've talked to, they anticipate, because they only come, mm-hmm. once a year, that there could be 1,000 fans a game.
That'd be wild. It'd be absolutely wild. Listen, Bob, we appreciate you doing this. Congratulations to you and the Wolfpack. Thank you very much for bringing the trophy, and best of luck in Super League. It's, like I said, it's been quite a ride, and it's going to continue.
Well, thanks. It's great being on the show.
Thank you so much. Bob Hunter is chairman and interim CEO of the Toronto Wolfpack. They will be going into the Super League of Rugby League. It's Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Network.
Anytime is anytime. Subscribe to the Primetime Sports Podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Sports has its own language. These guys speak it fluently and easily translate it for the masses. Jeff Blair, Stephen Brunt. This is Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
A reminder that you can win one of 50 $500 prize packs and qualify for our grand prize sports weekend getaway, including tickets to see both Toronto teams back-to-back with the VTech wake-up call. Give us a call at 416-413-4141. Leave us your best Toronto sports take. Set your alarms to 8:20 a.m. every Friday morning for the VTech wake-up call and lead off with Ashley Ziggy and Scotty Mack. This contest is open to Ontario residents only. Visit sportsnet.ca/590 for details. The St. Louis Blues, the defending Stanley Cup champion St. Louis Blues, are in town tonight to play the Maple Leafs. Gord Stellick and Nick Elberger will have our Leafs Nation postgame immediately following the broadcast of the Yankees-Twins game on Sportsnet 590. The Fan, Stephen, the Blues are going for their seventh consecutive win against the Leafs. Needless to say, they have the Leafs number.
Yes, they do.
You no doubt heard in the update, Mike Babcock will continue with his rotation, the rotation that he's been using since the start of the year. So that means Jason Spezza will draw back into the lineup against the Blues. And we talked a little bit with Jeff Merrick about the Blues in our last segment. And one of the things the Blues did in the offseason was add Justin Falk to an already deep defense corps. And as Jeff Merrick said, it accomplished two things. One, it gives them a deep defense corps, which is never a bad thing. But two, it also gives them a little bit of backup in the event that Alex Pietrangelo, that the team does not come to a contractual agreement with him. Darren Pang is a St. Louis Blues TV analyst. Darren Pang joins us on Primetime. Darren, thanks so much for joining Stephen and myself. Quick question. I don't know if you can answer this or not, but as Jeff Merrick said, we know that Alex Pietrangelo is represented by Newport. Newport's offices aren't that far from here. Are you getting any sense that Doug Armstrong had a meeting with the Newport folks planned for this little stop off in Toronto?
Oh, I would absolutely imagine that that's part of the plan. Doug did not travel with the team yesterday. We left about 2 in the afternoon. He had a couple of games he was looking at, and then I know he was coming into Toronto, and he's got his staff here. He's got Larry Robinson and Al McGinnis and Rob DiBio and Tim Taylor. But I think, you know, I mean, when you're dealing with a player, especially of the significance of Alex, and you know the Newport is right here, you assume that you're going to at least have a meeting. But that, you know, just because you might be meeting or not meeting, you know, head-to-head, it doesn't mean these guys haven't had active conversations anyway. So it is going to be interesting to see how this goes. We all know that Newport is the most, or if not the most powerful, you know, agency around. And, you know, let's face it, these negotiations aren't that easy. But you mentioned before about Justin Falk possibly, you know, being a security blanket. I think he traded for Justin Falk because it was a hockey deal that made this team better and signed him to a really good AB. For me, 6.5 for Justin Falk, a three-time All-Star. I thought he got him under wraps. I thought he signed him to a good deal, and it makes the team better. And I don't think it's going to have that much of an effect on Alex Pietrangelo, to be honest with you. And so the hope is that Alex gets re-signed and he continues to be the captain of the Blues.
Darren, we were also talking to Merrick about this earlier. How do you follow a crazy miracle season, like a season like it, there's no real precedent for what happened with the Blues last year, and you know, I kind of wondered about how you restart. I guess, you know, Jeff suggested that one of the things, I guess, from a point of view, with the player's point of view, is you realize nothing's impossible, right? You can dig yourself as much of a hole as you can, and you can still get out of it, and you know that about yourself. But what else is going, the kind of aftermath of that year for the Blues, how do you restart after that?
Well, I guess number one, the team, they knew they were a good team beforehand. And as you well know, they were actually pretty disappointed with their start.
I mean, but at the end, and I was talking to David Prawn about it the other day, he said, like, at one point they were 9 points out, but they had five games in hand, and they were just starting to play real well. So they always had those games in hand that people didn't look at, and that was a big, big thing for them. But going back to your original question, I think because of what the St. Louis Blues went through in a team sport, I think every team, no matter what level, can look at them as example A of never giving up and never quitting. And this whole thing about, you know, American Thanksgiving or December 1st and you'll never make the playoffs if you're behind, I'm glad that's finally been a little proven wrong. And I hope that other teams do the same thing and continue to battle on, because I saw it firsthand with these St. Louis Blues, how they battled, how they never gave up. They played for one another. They went out with one another. Like, they're a good group of guys. They're old school. They hang out together. They can go into the wee nights together, but they can show up the next day and they can battle their rear ends off. So they're a very unique group of guys, and I know that they're ready for this year as well. I wouldn't write them off as being contenders, you know, this year. I think they're going to be a really good team all season long.
Darren, watching this team, so watching them day in and day out as you did last year, did you believe, like, when they, when, you know, you, I say you look at games in hand, you can look at a variety of things, you know they're a better team than they looked like in the first half. But, you know, in January, when you looked at that team, did you think, not, and never mind the Stanley Cup, but did you think they could dig themselves out and make the playoffs?
Not January 1st, probably middle of February. There was a home and home against the Nashville Predators where they went in, and I'd have to ask Peter Laviolette about that a year later, but I thought that that was a huge turnaround for both teams. The Blues went in there and absolutely hit everything in sight and punched them right in the mouth. Great goaltending from Binnington, and they won back-to-back convincingly. I believe it's 4-1, 4-1, something like that. And I looked after that, and I said, this team can win it all. They've just beat a great team. They went into every tough building and beat them. They played a big boy game whenever their backs were against the wall. The problem they had was they didn't have any confidence on home ice. That's where they got beat up. Their road record was terrific. Jake Allen was great on the road, but we couldn't get a goalie to be great at home. And once Binnington came on board, the fans just lit up. Everything he did was the right thing. The fans backed him up, and that was the beginning of the confidence for me. So I would say middle of February, I felt like the St. Louis Blues could really do some damage.
You should have bet that, my friend. you could have done real well.
No, I told my dad, who lives in Fernie, B.C., I said, Pop, put whatever fish niggles you got on them. I said, I like them a lot.
Hey, what were you looking for from Jordan Binnington when he came back in camp this year, Darren, as a former goalie? What were you looking for? Like, what are you interested in seeing from him?
I was interested in seeing sharpness. I was interested in seeing good technique. Not someone that was going to go in the net and wave at pucks. I was going to see work ethic. I mean, you just won it all. You just did something that no rookie goaltender has ever won 16 games and won the Stanley Cup. So what are you going to be like? I liked what I saw. I thought his camp last year, I went back on my notes in training camp. I thought his camp last year, he was sent down, but I thought he was terrific. And I think this year he's been really, really good. So you look at little details, right? Is he paying attention to the rush? Is he paying attention and battling in the crease? Is he fighting for loose pucks, or is he nonchalant? Is he, you know, as I say, waving at pucks, or is he right there? And so far, I mean, I think this kid is a great kid. He's got about 900 layers of thick skin. And as he said to me the other day, he says, you know, I kept getting sent down, and it was about time the squeaky wheel got some oil. And he just kept, you know, saying things to coaches and saying things to Doug Armstrong. And he finally got his opportunity. And boy, he didn't disappoint, did he?
No, and that's why I was asking the question, because I'm wondering, that's such a great attitude when your team's winning and when you're going on to win a Stanley Cup. And I guess my concern would be, from a distance, is does he have to channel that a bit differently now this year?
Yeah, I don't know how anybody channels it when they're so calm under fire. I wasn't calm under fire, so I was a little bit more energy laden and had all kinds of angst building up in the game. But I think this guy can, he just got long-term ability in him because of the way he handles everything. Like, nothing seems to faze him. I mean, it's all about proving everybody wrong every single day. I asked about his contract. 2 years, $4.5 million from $650,000. He says, yeah, it's a good start. We've just got to keep getting better on that one, too. And I'm like, wow. Like, he's I don't know. He's got a real neat goaltending mentality about him. The same kind of mentality I've seen from all the great ones. They've got an air of confidence, and they've got just a different layer than other guys have.
You know, one of the big stories last year, obviously, with Team Whistler, was the coaching change and how it worked. You know, it doesn't always work, and it doesn't work often necessarily when a guy steps up from assistant to head coach. It's such a different relationship with the players. I just wonder what, you know, starting a fresh season now as the number one guy, how that's changed something, changes things, if it does for Craig.
Yeah, I don't think anything changes for Craig. I've been just entirely impressed with how he's handled this again. He just got such a direct approach. I think there's something to be said about honesty. Like, these players in the locker room are not dumb people. You know, maybe they're not book smart. Maybe they didn't all go to university. But they know people. And they know who's a phony and who's a fraud. And they can tell you that in about five games if they've got a coach or an assistant coach or a teammate that's a phony. And I got to tell you, there's something about Craig Berube that everybody, they want to go through a brick wall for. And he's not overly stubborn, that he's not going to have a conversation, but he's going to tell you that you're not good enough. And if you want to play more, then you better play better. And that's it. And when he gives you chances, like he gave Zach Sanford plenty of chance in training camp, Zach Sanford didn't take advantage of it. And now he's getting back in the lineup because of an injury to Robert Thomas. He has to take advantage of it because he was given the chance from Craig Berube. He deals with the trainers. He deals with the GM, he deals with the broadcasters, and he deals with the players the exact same way. Absolutely no phoniness about the way he is.
Darren, on the ice, what is going to be Justin Falk's impact in terms of the options he may present Craig and his coaching staff?
A lot of great options. Number one, they've got him paired with Vince Dunn right now. Started him with Petrangelo, but two right-handers. I didn't think that was working. The last game against the Dallas Stars, every touch that he had with the puck was right on the tape. I think what's going to happen is all the good players are going to want to play with Justin Falk because they want the puck on their tape, not off the glass, not flipping up high. And I think he's going to become a real popular player. I already saw that he joined the big card table on the plane, so that tells you he's a real likable guy. I just believe that the second power play unit, or if he ends up on the first power play unit, will be much better than last year, especially in the playoffs when it really struggled, because I think he's got really good instinct. He knows when to shoot the puck, and he knows when to make a play. And I think the players are going to like playing for Justin.
I'm interested in the impact that Mark Savard may have in this team. He's a guy we got to know well here for his work as one of our analysts. Tremendously skilled player. What type of an impact will he have, and how will he fit in that coaching staff, Darren?
Yeah, so far so good. I had a good talk with Mark today. We're both Ottawa area guys, and I know what kind of a skilled player he was. Dealing with, you know, NHL players, even now as compared to when he retired, doesn't seem like that long ago, but players have changed. And I know that, you know, you go on down the bench and you're in the preseason and you're dealing with Vladdy Tarasenko in a certain, you know, aspect of the game. You've got to know this person. You've got to know the personality. So I think at the beginning, that was probably a bit of a challenge for him. But I think as far as his skill level and his confidence with Craig Berube, because they were teammates together, I think it's going to be a nice compliment. I really do. I think there's an eye that you have to have from a high-end skill player that can really help the other guys. I mean, no offense, but I mean, you know, Chief, as he says, he didn't get very much power play time. Right. Otter got a little bit of power play time. Mike Van Ryan did as well. It's a young coaching staff, but I think having the eyes and ears of Mark Savard is going to be really good.
Darren, what do you from a distance? You're coming in to play this Blues are coming in to play this Leafs team tonight. A lot of offseason contract drama with the Leafs. Crazy high expectations. A lot of intense interest, as there always is in this market. But you know, almost a sense of urgency in terms of, you know, got to get it done while these guys are in their primes. Got to get it done while they're under contract. Is Mike Babcock secure in his role? What does, you know, if you're looking at the Leafs from a distance, what does this look like to you right now?
It looks like a pretty obvious thing. It's quite top-heavy. You know, I mean, that's what happens when you've got these great young players that are all in their entry-level deals, and they're all looking for big deals. And you know, you do your best to get them done. I think that, you know, I think maybe you look back at it and maybe the, you know, maybe the deal for Nylander, you know, maybe that deal could have been a tougher deal to make instead of a player holding out. And then you come back and you make a big deal. He makes a lot of money. Now you've set a pretty high standard right there. Kind of handcuffs you a little bit. I think everybody would say that. And I think experience would say that too to Kyle. But, you know, they've got some great players. I love this team, to be quite honest with you. I like the decor right now. I'm not sure how it stands up when you get into, you know, 4-7-game playoff series. I mean, that's what we found out with the St. Louis Blues. They're all big. They're all strong. They boxed out well, and they moved the puck up the ice. That'll be the biggest test for me for the Toronto Maple Leafs. But I like the goaltender, and I like the team. I think they can be a threat here this year.
You know, it's interesting hearing you say that, because after having watched this team go on a run and win the Stanley Cup, Darren, were you one of those people that sort of bought into the whole idea that, you know, the league's getting faster, it's getting smaller, there's more of an emphasis on skill, and then, you know, you see what the Blues did, and as you say, they play a heavy game.
You sound like Berkey here now.
Well, I'm channeling my inner Brian Burke, but it's true. It's a smaller, more skillful game, but then you look at the playoffs, and it still looks like the baton death march from a distance. Is that what you saw?
Well, I try to explain to people what kind of game the Blues played. And some people said, you know, maybe truculent was a word, or they ran people over, or, you know, big bullies in terms of the way they're physical. Listen, the game is supposed to be a faster game, but you can have slower players play a faster game. The St. Louis Blues are filled with players that don't have great foot speed. Let's go to Ryan O'Reilly, Tyler Bozak. You go, last year was Patty Maroon. You go to Alexander Steen. These are guys that just move the puck quick and they get into open spaces, and that's how they play fast. But what I did find out last year is that if you want to play a soft perimeter game, hoping that the power play is going to win you a hockey game in the playoffs, then you're sadly mistaken. It will not happen. Your 5-on-5 play has to be positive. Your penalty kill has to be in 90% or 92%. Your power play can falter all at once because you're going to win games 5-on-5 anyway. And you have to have four lines that are going to run you over. Ivan Barbashev's 190 pounds. He's not big and truculent, but he finished his check everywhere he went. Same, you know, the same thing could be said about, you know, when Zach Sanford was in the lineup, or, you know, Sammy Blay, who's having a heck of a start. These guys just finished their check. First man in, hit the guy. Second man quick, get the puck, third man high. It's very simple. There's nothing really magical about the way that they played. They just played hard and heavy and for one another.
Good stuff, Darren. Appreciate you doing this.
It is my pleasure. Anytime I can be joined up with Brian Burke's name and talk about tough hockey, I am all in.
You did say truculent. I know that was an homage. I know, to Brian. He appreciates it. I'm sure he's listening.
I said that for Burke. You know that.
Yeah, I know you did.
I know you did.
Thanks, Darren.
Take care,
all right.
Darren.
All right, guys. Take care.
Bye-bye. All right, Darren Pang, Blues analyst. Again, Blues and Leafs tonight at Scotiabank Arena.
That is going to be the discussion, though, Jeff. You know, again, whatever happens in October, November, December, et cetera, et cetera. They, you know, the Blues won the Stanley Cup by playing, you know, quote, heavy, unquote, hockey.
They played big person hockey.
They did.
They really did.
And, you know, it is a marathon, and it's, you know, all the cliches apply. And at some point, the question will be asked of the Toronto Maple Leafs, can you do that? Well, if you have to, can you play that game?
Well, that is the question that will be asked all regular. The Leafs could win 20 games in a row, and there's going to be a yeah, but. And it's not just going to be Brian Burke who's going to be saying yeah, but there's going to be a lot of people saying,
you got to win a playoff series. You know, exactly. That's you know, they are not built to play that way. They are built to play another way. By the design of this team is, you know, this is a sports car. That's it's not a tank.
No.
And if you design a team that way, if you're Kyle Dubas, you do that in the belief that you can win the Stanley Cup by playing that game. And I will not speak for Brian, but if he were here, he would say you can't.
Yes.
That's, you know, it's almost like a philosophical clash that we're going to see here. But the point is, we just saw those guys win a cup, you know, and dig themselves out of the deepest hole imaginable to win a cup and grind it out for four rounds.
They destroyed.
And we saw the Leafs lose in the first round. So until they win a series this way.
One of the things that was so much fun about watching the Blues And Darren referred to this about the whole Thanksgiving. They just basically destroyed every preconceived notion in the NHL in winning the Stanley Cup.
Yep.
Yeah. For the most part.
A whole bunch of them.
A whole bunch of them just fell by the wayside.
Yeah, and he's right about that idea. You know, if you are not here, you have a 97% probability of losing the playoffs if you have this record on January 1st. There's a lot of that stuff out there. We'd say, oh, there, you're done. Yep. Now, we see, you know, the fact is in all sports, almost all sports, certainly in sports like baseball where you have a long season, but, you know, I think you can dig yourself enough of a hole in the National Football League that you're not coming back to make the playoffs right. If you start 0-4. It's not happening. But, you know, we do see teams, you know, when you have a larger, you know, hockey where you have a large number of teams make the playoffs, that if you get in, you can dig yourself out of a hole. You can get on a late season run. You can win a round and gain a bunch of confidence. You know, changing coaches midstream in a dire situation, generally that doesn't work.
No.
But they got away with that too. It changed the emotional dynamics. So, yeah, it's good that stories like that can happen, right? It's what makes this interesting.
Yeah, it's nice to what it's done. Two things. One, it teaches the virtue of patience and the value of patience, which is something nobody has anymore. And we can argue whether Doug Armstrong was a genius or whether he just got kind of, you know, this is just the way things happen. But it really does also show you that sometimes you're not always down and out. And it's good to be reminded of that mm-hmm. at a time when a whole bunch of teams and a whole bunch of leagues seem to be tanking.
Now, if another team finds itself in the position the Blues are in the first week of January last year, I would not put a nickel on them. I don't think.
Oh, God, no.
It's not going to happen.
Of course.
Lightning's not going to strike there twice, I don't think. But it's good that, occasionally something happens which upsets expectations and prognostications and all of the expertise and all of the mathematics and seems to have something to do with belief mm-hmm. and effort and, you know, that whole kind of team thing. There's lots of talent there too, but you don't dig yourself out of that hole just purely on talent.
Not at all.
Because you wouldn't have gotten into that hole if talent was the only measure.
You talked about a coaching change that worked out, and it's a perfect segue into Amy Trask and our NFL segment. The Washington Redskins have fired their head coach.
Yeah, what was their
Jay
first?
Gruden.
Well, it couldn't happen to a nicer guy than Dan Snyder. So that's That's just fine. It's a colossal miss. They might have fired the wrong guy. They should have fired the general manager. But
well, that's another question. They are 0-5, and they're a mess. And as Stephen points out, a lot of that I think lies at the foot of the owner and also the general manager. Amy Trask will join us. We'll take a look at the NFL weekend. It's primetime on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Network.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Do not settle. Demand. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Now back to primetime sports on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
All right, welcome back to Primetime Sports. Jeff Blair and Stephen Brenda. Reminder, it's our final week from 4 to 7. Next week, we will be 2 to 5 with a different name. I mean, it'll still be Stephen Brent and Jeff Blair.
Yes,
and Richard
Deitch.
We're not changing our names, but the show will have a different name. And you'll have to wait and find out what it is, because I don't feel like telling you it right now. Stephen, would you have thought that Jay Gruden would be the first coach fired? I mean, that kind of comes as a real surprise.
Yes. Well, it's the surprise they didn't fire him 2 weeks ago.
Yes.
They took their time.
Well, yes. The final straw, I guess, a 33-7 loss to the Pats. It's not like Jay Gruden's the first coach to lose to the Pats. But the Washington Redskins are now 0-5. He was, or is, 35-49 overall. 35-49-1 overall. It's the first 0-5 start for the Redskins since 2001 and leaves them comfortably on track for their third straight losing season. Our NFL insider is Amy Trask, and she joins us on Primetime Sports. Hello, Amy.
Hello, men. How are you?
Us men are doing well, infinitely better than Jay Gruden.
You might be relieved, actually.
Oh, well, there is that.
I was about to say that. I'm not sure he's not feeling okay right now also.
Yes, he's out from under the thumb of Dan Snyder and Bruce Allen. And what a mess. Amy, I don't even know where to start with that. But like, I'm okay with bad things happening to Daniel Snyder. I think a lot of people are. But how do you fix what's broken football wise there, and who's really responsible for what's broken football wise?
Well, let me start by saying I think the problems are more than just football. It's not just broken from a football standpoint. You know, in the last couple of years, yes, we saw Scott McLuhan terminated, and then all the really bad, just kind of the terrible manner in which that happened. Because, look, people are terminated in all sorts of situations, but terminations can be handled respectfully and appropriately, and that one was not, in my view. But there have also been problems and are problems in the non-on-field areas of the organization, the business operations. Brian LaFemina hired from the league office to come over and oversee a tremendous amount of the business operations, let go very, very soon after he was hired. And then just this offseason, we saw what many referred to as a mass exodus of roughly 40 people from the organization. That was eye-popping. Men, you know, as I do, that jobs within the National Football League are coveted. For every job, there are umpteen people vying to get into an organization. So for almost 40 people to walk out in that sort of mass exodus, again, as many referred to it, was really stunning. So to answer your question, and I'm sorry that I've gone on and on, but I just want to make sure that the premise from my perspective is a little different than yours. It's not just problems in the football operations area of the organization, but the organization as a whole. And they seem to be systemic. They go back years and years and years. And I think there needs to be, you know, kids today won't understand this, but at some point you need to hit control, alt, delete, and do a reboot of a lot of different areas of the organization.
Yeah, but don't all those lines point to one guy, don't they?
Well, look, ultimately, in any organization, any business, the person or the people who own the business are ultimately responsible because they have ultimate control. And so even in organizations, and I'm talking now football, of course, even in organizations where an owner delegates authority and responsibility, that owner can ultimately terminate the person to whom he delegated it. So ultimately, then you circle back and it lands at the feet of the owner. Now, in this instance, a tremendous, tremendous of responsibility and authority has been granted to Bruce Allen. Ultimately, Dan Snyder has a choice as to whom he will delegate authority and responsibility. So you then go back from Bruce up to Dan.
Mm-hmm. So, and now Bruce is the guy, and again, you don't fire owners, sadly, but although the NBA did it, and with the Clippers.
But you got to do something pretty severe to be.
Yeah, it's hard to fire an owner. But, you know, Bruce Allen's record, you know, is not great. He does seem to maintain Daniel Snyder's trust somehow. You know, so again, purely from a football point of view, you know, they've had some things happen, like Alex Smith getting hurt. That's out of everybody's control. Maybe, you know, their quarterback situation would be a little more stable if that hadn't happened. But, you know, rate the job that Bruce Allen has done as general manager of the Washington Redskins.
Well, you know, let me tell you, let me just say this, and it goes to answering your question. Of course, injuries happen. And of course, they happen to really any team, and it's random and it's unexpected at times. But different teams prepare for things differently. Look what happened to Indianapolis this offseason. Andrew Luck retired on virtually the eve of the season. And although that discussion had been going on internally in the organization for a few weeks or a bit of time prior thereto, it wasn't something the organization knew last year during the draft or at a time where they could address it. But they already had. They had Jacoby Brissett there. They were prepared. So whether you have an injury, as did Washington with Alex Smith, or a sudden retirement, as did Indianapolis, part of the responsibility of the person running the organization is to have the organization ready when an injury hits. Now, you can't always be as ready as all organizations, you know, as Indianapolis was. But you got to have something there because, as you just noted, injuries happen. And look, my reason for raising the point that ultimately full authority rests with ownership was to make the point you just did. Ownership can ultimately terminate whoever ownership wishes. But you are absolutely 100% right. In this instance, the responsibility sits at this time, at this moment, on Bruce's desk, unless and until Dan decides to change that.
Yeah.
Shifting focus a little bit, Amy, the Dallas Cowboys lost 34-24 to the Green Bay Packers at home. They've now lost to the Saints and the Packers. They've beaten up some bad teams. What are the Cowboys? Should this loss change our opinion of the Cowboys at all?
I don't know that one loss should change our opinion, but what you just said should change the opinions of those who are thinking the Cowboys right now are at the top of the pack. Because as you just noted, it's not just one loss to Green Bay. There's the New Orleans loss. And interestingly, on CBS Sports, we had this discussion yesterday about which is the best team in the NFC. And one of my colleagues made an argument for Dallas. Hmm. And when he was done, I will confess to having quoted Samuel L. Jackson. And I said, well, allow me to retort. Because, you know, some people are arguing that it's Dallas. Some people have been arguing it's Seattle, another very, very good team. But right now, one team has beaten both Dallas and Seattle, and that's the New Orleans Saints. Now, I don't know that they're the best team in the NFC. We've only played 5 games out of 16. That's roughly a third of the season. So we don't know yet who's the best. But I do know that if we're going to evaluate teams based on who wins and who loses, New Orleans has beaten Dallas, and New Orleans has beaten Seattle. Last night, that was not just, as you noted, that wasn't just a loss. That was a loss with big L, big O, big S, big S. But it was one game. So let's see how they bounce back from that.
Yeah, and you talk about teams with a plan B in that. I mean, Teddy Bridgewater's, now granted, no one, I don't think you really ever want Drew Brees to get hurt, but Teddy Bridgewater's a pretty good plan B if you're the Saints, isn't he?
Oh, you raise a phenomenal point. Absolutely, positively, yes. And Mickey Loomis is to be commended for that. They went out and they went after him, and they spent more money than some people think a team should spend on a backup, but they did it. And it was a tremendous decision. Look, you said it earlier in the show. You're absolutely right. An injury can happen at any moment. And you look, or in the case of Indianapolis, a retirement. Look at Indianapolis with Brissett. Look at New Orleans with Teddy. These teams have had someone there when they've needed them.
What happens, you know, like Brees is going to come back, and and he will play when he comes back. But, you know, looking down the road, you know, Drew Brees is a 40-year-old Hall of Famer, hasn't lost a lot, it doesn't appear. He's kind of Brady-like that way. And Bridgewater's going to have some options. What do you think happens down the road with Teddy Bridgewater? Does he wind up somewhere else, given what he's done this year?
You know, he talked to that. He spoke to that last year in the offseason. And something very special exists in New Orleans with respect to the topic you're raising. Drew Brees is magnificent about helping younger, newer players at the quarterback position and otherwise. He is a teammate in the very best sense of the word, and he does all he can to help Teddy, who may eventually be the person who takes his job on a permanent basis, whether, you know, in a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, whenever that may be. He is very, very team-oriented and selfless. And Teddy recognized the unique circumstance in which he is playing in New Orleans, with an organization in which the starter is willing to help and guide and assist the person who may eventually replace him. It's a very special dynamic there, and I think Teddy recognizes that. Now, ultimately, if teams come after him and offer him caboodles of money, you can't fault him if he chooses to go elsewhere, because he's got to maximize his opportunity. Playing careers are, on average, very short. Teddy had an experience in which not only was his career at risk, you know, his limb and life were at risk. So I think he recognizes both how short a career can be and how one has to maximize it. And he also recognizes how fortunate he is to have seen him on the sideline crying during the anthem, his first game as a starter, and recognizing and publicly acknowledging that he realizes he's doing something that he thought he might never do again is really special.
It's a great story. And you know what? If he goes out and gets paid somewhere, I certainly don't begrudge him that. Like, I think all athletes should get what they can while they can. And Lord knows his career, he knows that better than almost anybody. She said it wasn't just his career that was threatened. His life was threatened. But it is such a good situation there, you know, and the coaching situation is such a good situation for him. And I don't know if you can balance that, for how long you could balance those two guys and how long they could balance those two guys payroll wise. But boy, on some level, you think this is in your best interest to stick around here, Teddy, if you can make this work.
I agree with you entirely. And one thing I find very frustrating is when fans criticize a player for making a decision that's best for that player. Because, as I said, on average, careers are very, very short. And Teddy's going to do exactly what you just said. He's going to have to balance being in a situation which is really terrific, being with a coach who is really terrific, being with another quarterback who works with other players in a manner that is really terrific, versus maybe another organization offering him a big, big, big check. And you know what? That's his choice. That's his decision. And none of us should ever criticize the decision a player makes in that regard. But your point circles back to what we were discussing at the beginning, which is the Washington team. Because let's say Washington comes in and offers him $1 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Or he can stay in New Orleans in the situation in which he is now for less money. And I'm using two extremes. Those are factors he's going to have to weigh. Do I want to be in Washington with all of the issues that are going on there, or do I want to be in an idyllic situation and maybe earn less? And again, that's just a hypothetical. I'm not suggesting that might happen, but it's his choice.
Yeah.
Amy, one of the talking points in the off season, specifically, I think it was surrounding Melvin Gordon, was just how the running back is no longer the glamour position. It, certainly when I started watching the NFL, the running back was a glamour position. Then I'm looking at Christian McCaffrey, though, and I found a number today that staggered me, because we're used to, not only has it been devalued in some ways, we're used to guys' specialization, all this. He's played 100% of the Panthers' offensive snaps in three of their five games this year. Now, I understand he's a good pass receiver in addition to a running back, but is he a throwback? Is that the simple way to look at Christian McCaffrey, or is he an outlier? And there is a difference, right?
Well, you're making great, great points, but I don't know that he's the throwback or the outlier, or he is simply being used in a spectacular manner. The best coaches, best position players to be their best. Mm. I mean, look, he is terrific, but there's good backs on other teams that, in my view, just aren't being deployed appropriately. And, you know, I don't devalue a running back. Everything you just said is accurate. I'm the outlier then in this regard. I have never devalued running backs. Backs do so much more than carry the ball. They're involved in pass protection. Look at Ezekiel Elliott in Dallas, last night not being the best example to cite about anyone in Dallas. But as a whole, and even looking back to seasons past, he is phenomenal. He's great at all sorts of pass protection. So when you're analyzing a running back, it's not just carries. It's not just receptions. It's, are you helping with pass protection? Are you picking up the blitz? I think running back is a really important position. And yes, I'm the outlier.
What did you, Amy, what did you make last night? The Chiefs offense being shut down at home. Obviously Mahomes is hobbled in that game, and that changed things more than I think a lot of people would have imagined. But I'm wondering if we're selling the Colts defense a little short by just talking about him being hurt, because they played a tremendous game in a really tough place to play a tremendous game.
Well, I think the answer to what you just said is yes, 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 and yes. It is an incredibly difficult place in which to be the road team. I spent almost 30 years in the AFC West, and that was I probably put it at the hardest road environment in which we played, in terms of just the cacophonous fan, and those fans are tremendous, and they are cacophonous, and their energy is palpable, and they make it very, very hard on visiting teams. So yes, Indy did a magnificent job with that. Yes, Mahomes was hobbled, and I do think there's more that had more of an impact than perhaps others do. I agree with you on that as well. And remember also, Indy's defense had the benefit of Justin Houston. Justin Houston spent all those years in Kansas City, was let go in the offseason, and signed with Indianapolis. And he acknowledged that on that 4th-and-1 play, the one on which my brain almost exploded, because you have 1 yard to go and you handed the ball to someone 7 yards deep. My brain didn't almost explode because of these two teams, but because of that play calling situation in general. It's bugged me my entire career. But Justin Houston, after the game, said he absolutely knew what they were going to run.
Mm-hmm.
He knew from the formation. He knew. He told his teammates, here's what they're going to do, and he stopped them. So that's another benefit the Colts defense had. But whatever the reasoning, they shut down a very, very, very powerful offense, and I was surprised by the game, given that it was in Kansas City.
Yeah, and the flips, and the, and again, the other flip side of that is that the Colts ran the ball right down their throat. They, you know, that Kansas City defense looked really vulnerable, which kind of makes you wonder, you know, when we get to December and January, whether once again, whether they're going to have the stuff to, you know, to beat a New England team in the playoffs or whoever they're going to have to beat in the playoffs. It just, there were some familiar echoes there of, you know, things that have happened with the Chiefs in the past. It felt like, you know, again, aside from the Mahomes injury.
Right. And, you know, a lot of people have pushed back when, well, there's been criticism, as you know, and as you just pointed out, of the Kansas City defense for more than just this season. And the response from many has been, look, if you're scoring as many points as they are per game, well, then the defense can give up some points. And look, I get it. That's math. At the end of the day, you just want more points on your side of the scoreboard than on the other team's side of the scoreboard. And guess what? You win. But is it fair to always assume and count on your offense to be scoring that many points to make up for a defense which is giving up a lot of points?
Amy, as always, it was great of you to join us. Thanks so much. Be well.
Thanks for having me.
Take care. That's Amy Trask of CBS Sports. If you're interested, by the way, the Kansas City Chiefs were limited to 22 minutes and 45 seconds.
Yeah. No, they
And I mean,
they owned the second half. The Colts owned the second half. Mahomes couldn't run.
No.
And it's.
And he didn't have. I mean, he doesn't have Tyreek Hill. And he didn't have Sammy Watkins. He was done. He lost his left tackle and left guard.
But it's still a great offense, right? And they And they got. It wasn't like, you know, he could run downfield a little bit, but his lack of mobility against the defense was playing really, really well. Like they just owned them in the second half. And again, they ran the ball, ate the clock, pushed them around. The Indy offensive line just pushed the Kansas City defensive line all over the field. And yeah, Mahomes was hurt and hobbled. Mm-hmm. But I'll tell you something. You looked at that and you said, man, if this looks a little like a playoff game. And someone else is going to push these guys around. And they're going to, you know, Andy Reid better, that crew better figure out a solution. You know, first of all, they're going to stop the run. And then, you know, if you set out to win playoff games 42-35, you're not going to succeed in that league.
Well, I was going to say.
I wish you could, but I think it's hard to do.
I was going to say, conversely, you know, very quietly, Indianapolis is 3-2. They've got two really good lines. They're strong on the offensive line. They're strong in the defensive line. I mean, they've kind of very quietly put themselves in the picture.
Yeah, they have. You know, it's an interesting division. You know, Houston's really, you know, Houston's good.
Mm-hmm.
And but they are, and Jacoby Brissett, you know, you have a all world quarterback just announces to retire. He's going to retire before the beginning of the season. Jacoby Brissett's a plan B, but he's, you know, not a real plan B. And yet, you know, he played a smart game last night.
Yep.
He, you know, I don't want to say game manager because that's an insult.
That's
to a
horrible
guy,
thing to say about any quarterback.
No, they just kept doing what worked, right? If they couldn't stop their run, they'll keep running the ball. And yep. I thought he played really, really well. They all played really well last night. That was a real team win for the Colts.
Just an update. It is 4-4 between the Cardinals and Braves. They're in the bottom of the ninth inning, and the Cardinals have a runner in second after a throwing error, one out. That game is on Sportsnet. The Dodgers and Washington is currently, Dodgers and Nationals are currently in Sportsnet 1. 8 o'clock will be the Yankees and Twins. Don't forget, Leafs and Blues, Leafs Nation post game immediately following the Yankees-Twins on Sportsnet 590 The Fan with Gord Stellick and Nick Alberga. So, there you go. A busy weekend, a busy Monday. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back tomorrow. Good night from Toronto.